see if you can lower the.
Okay, members, I'm going to call the conference committee to order. Welcome to the Conference Committee for the Women's Economic Security Act. What we're going to do today is have staff go through the side-by-sides and compare the House and Senate versions so we have a clear understanding of what the different versions are. And then we will take testimony after that. Obviously, if members have questions after staff goes through the language, I'm sure they will. And then we'll go to testimony followed by more questions from members. So I was just told I need to run up to the House chambers briefly, so I'm going to leave the gavel with Senator Pappas, but we'll have staff start to go through the bills. Thank you.
And
members were making more copies of the side-by-sides, I'm told, so more people have them.
Okay, I'll see you in a minute. So Senator Steben has a bill up on the Senate floor, so I'm sure as soon as that bill is done and I go up and vote for it, then she'll be here. I'm Senator Sandy Pappas, and I wanted to welcome everyone as well to the conference committee. It's very exciting for us to be offering the Women's Economic Security Act. We know that we kind of all share the same goals, and that is equality for women in the workforce. And we're concerned about the, I think we were calling it the motherhood disadvantage, and some of the research that women shouldn't have to choose between having a family, because this is really about women and their families, and whether they want to participate in the economy by having a job and a career. And it's we know that women have really added a lot of economic vitality to the country since World War II, when women entered the workforce in greater and greater numbers, especially in the last 20 years. And I believe we may still have the highest percentage of women in the workforce in our state. Which is 50%, right, Deb? Something like that, of mothers are in the workforce. So with that, then, I'm not sure who's going to do this, if it's going to be, hi, how are you?
Good,
Ms. Newman,
you.
Or Mr. Fuller, or Mr. Shepherd, or?
I'm Helen Roberts from the fiscal staff.
Roberts, okay, nice to meet you. Yeah, I think we've met before over the years. let's start with just introducing the members of the conference committee. And Senator Rosen, do you want to start?
Yes, thank you. I'm Senator Rosen from District 23. Served just about seven counties down in southern Minnesota. And I'd like to say a special thank you to our only male on our conference committee, which I apologize that you're the only male. But
that's okay.
But I understand he has four daughters. So
oh, so he is surrounded by females. So yeah, he's
qualified.
Very familiar with it. That's right. And it's an honor to be on this conference committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And I mentioned I'm Senator Sandy Pappas, and Representative Carly Moline introduced herself.
Good afternoon. And my name is Representative Rena Moran, representing District 65A in St. Paul, and also honored to be a part of this conference committee. Thank you.
And Representative?
Thank you. And Representative Krishan, and thank you, Senator Rosen. As you mentioned, I do have four daughters, but I don't know that you're ever qualified to be on this committee, but I'm certainly honored. My interest spans way back as an entrepreneur who has been especially interested in helping in the rural counties and around the state, but female business owners and entrepreneurs and women-owned businesses. And with four daughters and an oldest son that I just saw after the Air Force, this is especially important to me, and like I said, I'm truly honored to be on this committee and looking forward to it.
Is it my turn?
Sure.
I'm out of breath. I guess we're doing introductions. Mm-hmm. I'm Carly Moline, State Representative. I represent portions of the Iron Range, parts of Itasca and St. Louis County, so up in northeastern Minnesota. I've always been really interested in these issues. My part of the state in particular has a very high income gap between men and women, and it's something that I've wanted to address since being here at the House. And I think that we have a really exciting opportunity in front of us to finally be able to address that. So I'm looking forward to working together, especially on this bipartisan bill that we had come out of both bodies. I think it's pretty exciting. So look forward to the conference committee and hearing further testimony and putting together a really good conference committee report that can get broad support in both bodies.
Representative Moline, I did want to introduce my committee administrator, Kara Josephson, but I don't see her right now. Oh, Kara, you should sit up here. So I have you when I need you. That's why I introduced you, so I can come up here. And so many of you stakeholders in the room do know Kara. She's been working very diligently on this bill. And once again, if you need any information or need to convey anything to us, you can certainly talk to Kara on our side.
Did you get introduced?
And on the House side, we have Abu, who's going to be working with the conference committee. So feel free to ask him any other questions you may have as well.
Okay. No, we just are ready. Fuller.
Mr. Fuller, did you...
I don't want to say anything.
Okay.
The question was posed to me regarding how we go through the bill. Mm-hmm. So I thought, Ms. Newman, it's a House file.
Yeah.
She could go, and I would, section by section, I could comment. There's a chart that we worked on. I think Mr. Shepherd knows the basic section.
Yeah, my intent was to have Ms. Newman go through the bill, and then, you know, Mr. Fuller, if you want to step in at any point to clarify Senate provisions as we're going through the bill, and then have Mr. Shepherd probably focus on the equal pay portions of the bill. So
sounds good.
That's okay with everyone. Ms. Newman, do you want to begin?
Chair Moline and members of the conference committee, and then one additional thing, perhaps after we get done with the side-by-side, Ms. Roberts could run through the spreadsheet comparing the appropriations in the bill, if that would be okay.
Yes.
Okay, members, on page R1 of the side-by-side, the citations of the two bills are identical, so that's a good start. Article 2 in Section 1 of the House deals with data relating to the pay equity certificates. And Mr. Shepherd, when we get to the pay equity area, we'll discuss that in more detail. Section 2.
Ms. Newman, so on that first one, we don't have everything. What the House provision is what the appropriate way to do this data privacy or data practices act. So I talked to our counsel, and we should do what the House did there on Section 1 and the House on 1.25.
Madam Chair, so continuing on R1, House Section 2 and Senate Section 1 are virtually identical, but for a couple of words on page R2, this is where there are advisory members appointed to the Governor's Workforce Development Council to represent individuals with expertise in helping women obtain employment in non-traditional occupations. The House uses the modifier high wage, high demand throughout this bill in applying it to the non-traditional occupations, and that is picked up in this area as well.
Moving on to R3, the Senate has some language where there's no comparable language having to do on 3.15, our Section 2, workforce program outcomes. Just note that in the supplemental budget bill, I think this section is being amended as well, so we should pay heed to make sure that we don't conflict with what they're doing. But there's no comparable House position.
And Madam Chair, Representative Moline, you will recall the language in Senate Section 2 was in your bill originally and was removed in the Jobs Committee through an author's amendment, I think because of cost reasons. And furthermore, on R3, House Section 3, Senate Section 3 are identical in the language on page R3. The gist of the two sections are very, very similar. The House on R4 defines the terms high wage, high demand, and low income and uses that throughout this area. So many of the differences, as you'll see down the rest of the page, are just the modifiers high wage, high demand, and applying that to the concept of these non-traditional occupations. Low income is 200% of poverty. The House modifies that by adjusting it for the family size of 4, and the Senate doesn't have that modifier. Page R5, again, the differences are basically the addition of high wage, high demand by the house in modifying non-traditional occupations. Page R6 and R7 are House and Senate provisions dealing with unemployment insurance, voluntary quits, and unemployment misconduct. And it just adds, both of these sections add domestic abuse, sexual assault, and stalking to the list of items that would not disqualify a person for a voluntary quit for unemployment benefits and would not be considered employment misconduct for the purposes of unemployment benefits.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Pop.
Ms. Newman, then they're identical, the House and the Senate?
Madam Chair, yes, in that we both have a little snafu with where we, on page R7, beginning on line 719 in the House and 18.21 in the Senate, our definitions of domestic abuse, sexual assault, and stalking are the same, but we have to figure out a better way of having them apply to both both of these subdivisions where they're used, and that would just be a technical fix that Mr. Fuller and I would make. But yes, the language otherwise is identical.
Ms. Newman?
Then moving to page R9, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Shepard because we're moving into the pay equity.
Madam Chair and members, on page R9, I'll go over the main differences here in the equal pay certificate provisions, and Mr. Fuller can jump in as well. On the House side, the first difference is the House bill applies to state agencies. The Senate bill applies to state agencies, but also applies to metropolitan agencies. So that's the first difference. The House bill applies to businesses with 50 or more full-time employees, and the Senate is 40. So that's the second difference on the entities covered by the bill. The exclusions are fairly similar, except that on the Senate side, on the bottom of page R9, lines 7.8 and 7.9, the Senate has an exclusion for contracts entered into by the State Board of Investment for options under the MSRS deferred comp plan.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crescia.
Before we move on, Mr. Shepard, just so I'm clear, because I was looking at the language differences, specifically what's covered, which entities are covered on the House bill and which entities are covered on the Senate bill, if you could just make that clear, that would be. You had mentioned the Met Council, but just specifically.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and Representative Crescia, yes. First of all, in both bills, they apply to contracts with a business, contracts in excess of $500,000. So that's the same in both bills. The House applies to businesses that have 50 or more full-time employees in Minnesota or a state where the business has its primary place of business. The Senate is 40 or more. And then on the public entities covered, the House applies just to state agencies, and the Senate also applies to state agencies, but then it applies to the Met Council and the Airports Commission, the Mosquito Control Commission, and Sports Facilities Commission. So it would apply to those metropolitan agencies in addition to the state agencies.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the major difference, I think, in this whole section, one of the major differences is relates to the language on page R9 on the House side. It's the requirements for a certificate of compliance. And at some point, the conferees will probably want to discuss this in more detail. But for now, you'll see the House has five clauses that must be satisfied before the Commissioner of Human Rights can issue an equal pay certificate of compliance. And the first one, compensation policies or practices are based on and comply with certain laws. That's very similar to a Senate provision on page R10. Some of the other ones, probably the biggest difference on the House side is in clause 5, lines page R9, line 9.18 to 9.23, the requirement that the business certify that the average compensation for its female employees is not consistently below that for male employees in the EEO EEO in each of the major job categories in the EEO 1 report. And there's nothing parallel to that on the Senate side. So that's a difference between the House and the Senate. There are some other differences. The Senate criteria are over on page R10. And so you'll see on the right-hand side of the page, for example, on Senate line 7.24 to 7.32, all of those statements are not included on the House side.
So, Mr. Shepard, just for clarity, so on the R9, the factors 1 through 4 in the House version, are those the same as what's in the Senate version, just on the R10? Looks like they're slightly different.
Madam Chair and members, yes, they are slightly different. They're not exactly the same, but in my view, these are things that the conferees, I think, would probably, they're conceptually similar, but different words used. The House trying to ensure that wage schedules, other compensation not based on the sex of employees, that the business doesn't restrict employees of one sex to certain job classifications, and that contributions to benefit plans are not related to or based on sex. And the Senate basically by saying that the business has to be in compliance with all of the federal and state non-discrimination laws is probably picking up a lot of those things. And some of the other the statements are the House, each chamber took a slightly different approach to this. So I don't see these as being in major conflict with each other. They were just expressed a little bit differently. But I think Clause 5 on the House side is something that is a kind of certification or information that's a little bit different than anything on the Senate side.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And just to dovetail a bit off Chair Moline's question, and Mr. Shepard, you mentioned this. What, in your opinion, is the concept that we're trying to get to so that we can clearly state that? I mean, you're right. The language is technically different, but I just want to – I think we should be clear on exactly what was the concept that you thought we were trying to achieve.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, that might be a question for the two chief authors to address.
And that's fine. Maybe it's more rhetorical. I'm just trying to get to the heart of that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Shepard.
So, Madam Chair, continuing on to page R10, you'll see at the bottom the House has some provisions relating to an audit. The Senate also has some provisions relating to audits. It is in a different place. The chambers organized this language a little bit differently. But if you look on page R12 on the Senate side, subdivision 8, lines 8.30 to 8.34, the Senate also gives the Commissioner of Human Rights authority to audit compliance to determine exempt status or with respect to request information necessary to determine compliance. So the audit language, again, both the House and the Senate have that concept, but it is expressed a little bit differently. And because the House and the Senate have different standards to start with, what would be audited would be a little bit different, too. Madam Chair, both bodies have provisions governing the revocation of certificates and revocation of a contract. There are some pretty nuanced differences there that I could explain in detail when you're ready to discuss those. But my sense is that once you determine what standards you want for these certificates of compliance, you might have an easier time determining how you want, what process and standards you want to suspend or revoke contracts or certificates. I think it'll follow a little bit from the standards that you pick to start with. So I won't go through those in detail right now unless you'd like me to. Madam Chair, that carries over all the way over to R12 then. Mr. Fuller mentioned earlier in the middle of the page that there's provisions relating to access to data. Both the House and the Senate protect the data that companies would be submitting. And at the very, very beginning of the bill, the first section that Mr. Fuller mentioned is just a cross-reference in the Data Practices Act to these provisions. On page R12 on the Senate side, subdivision 10, the Senate has a report that would be made on January 31st of every even-numbered year. Actually, the House has a report, but it's a one-time report, so it appears in the side-by-side at the end of the article on page R17. The substance of the reports is fairly similar, but the Senate would be a permanent ongoing one, and the House is just one time. So, and a little bit later on in the bill, Ms. Roberts can talk about the appropriations for this function. But for now, that covers these sections.
Do members have questions for Mr. Shepherd at this time regarding these provisions? I just had a quick question on the R11. Is there a difference between revocation of a contract and voiding of a contract, or is that just a language difference?
Madam Chair, if you look at the bottom of R11, the two head notes, are different. The Senate head note refers to revocation of a contract, but the substance of the Senate language refers to voiding the contract. So I think the House and the Senate did not intend something substantively different here, and it's probably something that you could decide fairly easily.
Okay, thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Shepherd, just to go back to Section 6 of the House, 9.8 to 9.17. Did I hear correctly, would that be similar or be embodied in the Senate language on R10 of 7.17, the Civil Rights Act? Those four pieces,
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, not exactly. The House Clause 1 on lines 9.8 to 9.11, I believe, is identical to Senate on page R10, line 7.17 to 7.19. It's referring to Title VII, the Equal Pay Act, Minnesota Human Rights Act, and the Minnesota Equal Pay for Equal Work Law. So I think that part is identical. And I'm going to ask, Mr. Fuller might have something to add here, too, I think.
Mr. Fuller.
Well, if you look at the language on 9.8 and 9.9, I think there is a significant difference between the two, because they both reference the law. Which I think, if you step back and look at the big picture, we're requiring businesses to do something, so we should make sure they know what they're supposed to do. They're complying with the law. They can buy certified that. But the phrase for compensation policy. Its compensation policy and practices based on the principle of equal pay for equal work is a little more than compliance with law. So, I mean, can you have one without the other? You know, and so it raises that issue. Why is that necessary? And there's a couple of reasons why you have to make sure that it's something that they can actually certify to. Because my guess is that's not what their pay system is based on in its totality. They have a lot of other components. So I think that's one of the things the conferees are going to have to look at, mm-hmm. is making sure that there's conciseness in the ability to comply and to administer.
Okay. Any other questions from members on this provision? Mr. Fuller?
I think Mark, Mr. Shepherd and I had discussed that. I think I'll just repeat what he said, which is, there's a series of interrelated decisions you have to make, and you start out with what you want the businesses to disclose, and then what happens if either they don't abide by what they disclose or they disclose falsely. Who has authority to do what? And then how is that authority exercised? What's the process? Is there a hearing? Is there a notice? Is there an appeal? And sort through those. I think that's important to make sure that when you're dealing with an issue where you're going to void somebody's contract, that there's some process in place where there's a fact finding and ability to.
Ms. Newman, do you want to carry on with the rest of the bill?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you'll turn your attention to page R13. The two items at the top of the page are the appropriations for the non-traditional jobs grant program. Ms. Roberts will talk about the different sources of funding for these. I'll just point out that, again, this House concept of high wage, high demand on the modifier is repeated here. Section 8 of the House and Section 4 of the Senate are the appropriations for the Women Entrepreneurs Program. Despite the fact that it may look like the language is substantially different between the two bills, it is actually very, very similar. However, the structure of the program is quite different. In the House, the money is direct grants to Women Venture and the Women's Business Center of Northeastern Minnesota, and the Senate is done through a competitive grants program. But most of the thresholds are quite similar. The types of businesses, et cetera. It's just they're structured quite differently. However, page R14.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before we move on, and so as I was reading through that two language, just for my own sake, and maybe the way these are structured would either. Do you think the dollars will be appropriated across the state evenly on either way? And I don't know if you have that's one of the things I'm just wondering is if we took one side versus the other, obviously we're going to end up somewhere, but which one's going to spread the dollars more equally to those who really need it?
Well,
any thoughts?
I'll try to answer that. I think from my understanding in the House version, it's the direct appropriations to two entities. In the Senate version, it's open-ended, but there's also not a, from my understanding, and Ms. Newman, correct me if I'm wrong, not a cap on how much of that money any particular entity could get. So I guess you could end up in a situation where one entity got the whole grant. Now, whether or not that would result in more or less dollars being spread around the state, I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I think those are two differences in where the money would go geographically.
Okay.
House and Senate language.
Right, because, Madam Chair, it doesn't really say they have to be dispersed geographically or anything.
Okay.
So, well, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
I guess that is a very good question. Why was it appropriated to the Northeastern Women's Business Center of Northeastern Minnesota at the Northeast Entrepreneurial Fund? Because you have the initiative foundations throughout the state. You have many other vehicles that could be wonderful for something like this that could promote that. So as a legislator from Greater Minnesota, Southern Minnesota, we fight very hard to make sure that disparity, and as you know, you probably feel that somewhat too. But, for example, the Homeless Youth Act, which is a very good program, $4.2 million was appropriated last year for the act. I'm number two on the co-author with Senator Dibble. And it's always been a priority for all of us to have that disseminated equally throughout the state, but only about 180,000 of it was given to programs south of the I-94 corridor south, and the rest was to north and to the metro. So at 4 million to the metro and north and 180 south. And that is recognized that we definitely have homeless youth, so we have to make sure that we have appropriate programs to get this money out equally. So that's just a concern, is that we are so used to making sure that we get it out to Greater Minnesota in an equal way. So yeah. My question is, why the Northeast?
Well, from my understanding of Representative Mahoney's intent was he wanted to get sort of the money out the door as soon as possible, and these two entities have a history of doing this kind of work. One of them focuses more on serving Greater Minnesota. Women Ventures, from my understanding, serves the whole state. But you know, obviously, I too am concerned with making sure economic development, these dollars get to greater Minnesota. And I don't think there's a guarantee in the Senate language that that would happen because, as I noted, I think all of the money could go to one entity, and, you know, where they spend it, I think, would be up to them. Now, I don't know if we could address that in some language or not, but from my understanding, Representative Mahoney's intent was that the money gets out the door, one entity serves the state but is more metro-based, Women Ventures, and the other one serves greater Minnesota, granted, northern Minnesota. So I don't know if there's somebody here from either of those entities. It looks like there is someone here from Women Ventures, so maybe when we go to testimony, they can provide us some more insight on that.
Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair, then next, on page R14, are some appropriations in the House. This is the non-traditional apprenticeship appropriation, so this would be to the labor, to the Department of Labor and Industry, and Ms. Roberts will talk more about that. And the Senate also has an appropriation to the Department of Labor and Industry in the same amount. And page R15, I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Fuller and Mr. Shepherd. This is the retirement savings plan.
Mr. Shepherd? Mr. Fuller?
Both sections require a report on the issue of the ability of the state to offer the employees to utilize one developed by the state. They provide study for management and budget. And a lot of similar issues in both worlds. The appropriation level, I think, is about half in the House. They condition some of their study components on whether or not there was available money. Neither one is looking for state contributions or state liability. If something has to be worked out, I'm not particularly familiar with it come through and see my committee, but it looks like something where bodies are have the same thought, a lot of same components, different levels of money is driving a little bit of a difference in the language. And in fact, if you look at it, I believe that the language is identical. First paragraph.
Mr. Shepherd?
Yes, Madam Chair, I agree with what Mr. Fuller said. If you see the House bill, you'll note on the way it's structured, on line 13.8, there's certain things, as Mr. Fuller indicated, that the report must include. And these are pretty similar to things that are on the next page of the Senate bill, too. But then on the last line of R15 on the House side, as Mr. Fuller indicated, subject to available appropriation, the report may include. And that was done, as Mr. Fuller indicated, because some of the things on the next page appeared to be costly items, and so in an effort to keep the appropriation down, the House said those would be studied only to the extent of available appropriations.
Some numbers on this piece? Ms. Newman? Or Representative Creasy, did you have a question?
Yeah, just very quickly. So thank you, Madam Chair. And so, and I believe when this came through our committee, Mr. Shepherd. So the main appropriation difference is just what's in the report, what's required in the report. Is that correct?
Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair, Representative Creasy, yes, you're correct. If you look on page R17, okay, in the middle of the page, the House appropriates $300,000 for the report, and the Senate appropriates $750,000. And some of the things that the House said that the commissioner may study were thought, as you recall, in the State Government Finance Committee to be more expensive. Sure. Items to study.
We did good work in the committee.
Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair, page R18, Senate section, House Section 1 and Senate Section 3 are identical. This is defining who an employee is for the purposes of the leave law. House Section 2 and Senate Section 4 are identical except for one term on line 15.24. The House picks up a natural parent. That's just repeating what the current law language that is stricken on line 1520 is. The Senate changes that to biological. I think biological is a more contemporary term, and that's probably the preferable way to state that. So those those provisions are identical.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori caught that.
Page R19, House Section 3 and Senate Section 5, this is expanding the use of a person's sick leave benefits. The sections are the substantive parts in paragraph B on 1621 in the House and 1432 in the Senate are identical. There is one small change up on line 1616 in the House in that mother-in-law and father-in-law were added on the Senate floor in addition to
the House floor.
House floor. Both House and Senate add grandchild, which was an oversight when this law was enacted last year. Page R20 is a continuation of this leave law, and again, on 1633, the difference is the House has mother-in-law and father-in-law. Otherwise, those sections are the same. On page R20, Senate Section 4 and House Section 6, this is the pregnancy accommodation section, and I'll let Mr. Fuller perhaps talk about the differences.
Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, members, the two significant ones that are quoted on the Congress side are the concept, the Senate picked up a concept of undue hardship so that the employer, except with respect to certain minor accommodations, it's spelled out in the language, can show an undue hardship and then not have to do that particular accommodation. Both bodies say it's an interactive process. The employer comes, the employee comes in. This is my issue, and the employer responds, and try to develop an accommodation. But the difference between the House and the Senate is that the employer can say, wait a minute, I can't do what they're asking because it's going to impose an undue hardship. And that term was selected because it's currently in the Human Rights Act with respect to some practices in the body of the case. So, and then the other major exception that's noted is the issue of what does the employee have to show as far as documentation. The Senate for accommodation, the Senate accepts a certain minor accommodation, the same ones for which you can't show under hardship, said a medical provider, or I believe that you all have to say there's a medical necessity.
And Mr. Fuller, just for clarity, in the House version, we do adopt the undue hardship language as well in regards to when an employee requests a transfer, I believe. That's correct.
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes. The House in the accommodation language does not have the written documentation of medical necessity or the undue hardship, but the undue hardship is picked up in the transfer language that the House has on page R21.
So you do have that broadly applicable.
From members on this. Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair, I was just going to point out that the transfer language on R21 in the Senate is not matched by language in the Senate. Interaction language and the retribution language is the same in both bills. The Senate on page R21, beginning on line 1615, has an additional provision that says that an employee doesn't have to take a leave or an accommodation.
And then, Mr. Fuller, on the Senate version, except for the three accommodations that are spelled out on lines 15.34 to 15.35, except for those three things, would there have to be a note of a documentation of medical necessity and there's an undue hardship defense for anything other than those three?
Well, Madam Chair, there's sort of two responses. I think technically, yes, the employer, of course, cannot require them to provide an accommodation. I mean, should not claim undue hardship. So it's an option that the employer has. There's no prohibition on the employer not requiring.
Okay. Other questions from members? Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair and members, on page R21, House Section 5 and Senate Section 7, the relationship to other leave, that is an identical provision. On page R22 is the provisions in the nursing mothers language, and the provisions are very similar. The Senate has additional language that the area can't be a bathroom, and the House leaves it as a toilet stall. And they have additional modifiers about intrusion from co-workers and the public. And then the additional piece that the House has on line 19.8 and 19.9 is a cross-reference making this an unfair employment practice under the Human Rights Act, which the Senate doesn't have. And Mr. Fuller can talk about the enforcement language in the Senate.
Mr. Fuller?
Looking at R22, this was put in the document in the Senate. The choice was between making it a human rights violation, that triggers a number of provisions in the human rights law. And with this one, it mirrors some other employment law penalty provision. The commissioner gives a notice of a violation. And then, if it's not cured, for the first violation, there's a cap of $1,000 up to.
And what was contemplated was that you'd look at the action and the size of the employer.
Mr. Fuller, under the Senate enforcement provision, Department of Labor and Industry denies the complaint that the employee set forth. Where does the employee go from there?
Well, that's a very significant question because it has to do with some of the other provisions. Yeah. The law which makes things a human rights violation because of an employment violation. If the employer could show that in fact she was discriminated against because of her gender, we could file a human rights violation and pursue that. If the commissioner decided that there was no violation, the general rules of the private right of action created by a statutory right in the provision of the commission provided. So the end of the road, unless it was a human rights violation, it would be the end of the road for the employee under some collective bargaining agreement or some sort of union. But that, with the number of provisions, that's the sort of policy question. Do we convert something into a human rights violation because of its employment nature, or does there have to be something, some human rights type issue involved? You have to show that's because you're a woman that you fire for disclosing your wage. Or they also fire men. So that's an interesting question.
So then, Mr. Fuller, so then it would be the end of the road as far as a Dolly remedy would go, though, if the commissioner would.
I might ask Mark. I'm not sure if there's an appeal right of an administrative decision through the, if it was an administrative procedure type act.
Oh, darn.
Now you're really on record. Uh-huh. So.
I'm not sure if within the administrative processes, if somebody is denied a right or a claim by the commissioner in this circumstance, that they could pursue that through a district court or court of appeals. I don't want to put Mark on the spot if he doesn't know it, but he works more than this area than I do. What are your thoughts?
Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair and members, I think on the Senate side, it's probably unlikely that, as Mr. Fuller indicated, that there would be a private right of action if the conferees wanted to have one, it should probably be expressed directly. So I think under the Senate provision, the Department of Labor and Industry would have discretion to enforce laws like they do other laws.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does a human rights violation, does that automatically mean that it is, does it go into arbitration or a lawsuit, and how long How long are these lawsuits? How long does it take to go through some kind of litigation through the human rights?
Maybe Mr. Fuller, Mr. Shepard has a better answer. My understanding is there's a couple of avenues. I mean, the department can sort of take care of it through the department and sort of more of an arbitration setting with the employer and the employee, or somebody can file a direct claim in district court under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So you can either or both file a complaint with the Human Rights Act, or you can file a cause of action in district court. But Mr. Fuller, do you have more?
Madam Chair, you're right. And if you lose on the human rights claim, you can still pursue a court action. So if they find no probable cause for human rights violation, you can pursue it through district court.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And what is the time frame on that, Mr. Fuller?
I think I don't know off the top. The time frame for what? For filing a claim? Or
no, for
resolving a claim?
Right.
Well, on the court side, it's whatever it is. On the human rights side, there is a time period. There
Madam
must be
Chair,
some
we
here.
We do have the commissioner is going to be testifying.
I'm thinking 180 days, but I may be wrong.
We could either bring him up now, or he could address them when he testifies.
And, yeah, maybe we can wait for the commissioner. I think under the human rights statute, I know you have to bring a cause within a certain amount of time, but we'll have the commissioner answer those questions when he comes up, maybe. Are there other questions from members on this provision? No. Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair and members of the conference committee, continuing on page R22 begins a number of Senate or House sections that are not in the Senate bill. R22 through R25 makes discrimination against a family caregiver, which is defined in Section 2 on page R22, an unfair employment practice, and that is under the Human Rights Act. Moving to page R25. House Section 7 is a cross-reference in the Human Rights Act back to the language in 181 on nursing mothers about making it an unfair employment practice. House Section 8 and Senate Section 1, the wage disclosure protection language. All the language you see on page R25 in the House bill and the Senate bill is identical. However, the House has the language in the Human Rights Act, and the Senate codes the language in Chapter 181 in the employment law area. And then on page R26, Mr. Fuller can speak to the additional language that the Senate has.
Madam Chair, it's pretty self-explanatory. If you have a handbook, put in your give a notice to the employee of rights under this section, that wage disclosure prohibition on wage disclosures. Clause D on 12.23 is a retaliation prohibition for asserting rights. And three is the civil action. So you can bring a civil action against an employer for a violation of the paragraph if a court finds that the employer had violated paragraph A or D, not C. C is the handbook up above, so not the handbook one. The court may order reinstatement, back pay, restoration of lost service credit if appropriate, and expungement of adverse employment information. So, equitable relief. And back pay.
Questions? Ms. Newman?
And finally, on page R26 is an article in the House bill that the Senate bill does not have. This relates to early learning scholarships, and it removes the cap on the scholarship and replaces that with language directing the Commissioner of Education to establish a target for the average scholarships based on the results of a survey that is in the education or child care law.
Madam Chair.
Chair Pappas.
Madam Chair, I believe that this is on the Senate side in the omnibus budget bill, this issue with dollars attached to it. So we should really decide and consult with Representative Carlson and Senator Cohen about where this is going to be conferred. It's going to be in our bill or their bill.
Are there questions from members? Senator Rosen?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm back on R22, Section 2 of the House. The family caregiver, is this definition in statute?
Senator Rosen, we define family caregiver in on lines 9.12 to 19.12 to 19.15, and then familial status is already defined in statute, and I don't have the exact citation off of hand, but it's in the housing portion of the Human Rights Act, I believe, where familial status is defined. Mr. Shepherd, do you know?
Okay. Senator Rosen, this bill was introduced in the Senate, and it made it through a couple committees, judiciary, I'm not sure what else, but did not survive the Jobs Committee.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the author of the bill was?
Senator Wicklund.
Wicklund, okay. And so we are creating a separate class by designating family caregiver. That is a separate.
We're, Senator Rosen, adding
protected class or whatever.
Familial status and status as a family caregiver as protected classes under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. I don't have the definition of familial status in front of me, but I will get it to the committee. From my understanding, it includes basically just minor children under 18, and excludes stepchildren, I believe. And so we didn't want to change the definition of familial status because it is already defined in law, but we wanted to add family caregiver to add more, I guess, people that an employee could be caring for, like a adult child with disabilities or an ailing parent. And so those are included under family caregiver because they aren't included under the current familial status statute. But, yes, we are creating new protected classes under the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Yes. Okay.
Are there other questions from members before we go to testifiers? Oh, yes, we need to go through the spreadsheet. Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, and I can go through this fairly quickly. So everyone has a spreadsheet that looks like this. The first item on the spreadsheet is the appropriations to the Department of Human Rights, and you'll see that both the House and the Senate have equal levels of funding, $674,000 from the general fund, and then an additional $37,000 that comes from the special revenue fund. Those are from the filing fees. And the general fund base, again, is identical into the next biennium, $426,000 a year. The second item is the retirement plan report under Minnesota Management and Budget, and this was discussed through the walkthrough. The funding difference is $450,000, and that's due to the different reporting requirements between the House and Senate. Moving on to the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the difference here on the funding, both the House and Senate provide general fund funding in the amount of $500,000 for the Women Entrepreneurs Grants. The funding level is the same for the non-traditional jobs grants, $500,000 a year, but the difference here is the funding source. The House has the funding coming from the general fund, and the Senate has the funding coming from the Workforce Development Fund. And then finally, moving on down to the Department of Labor and Industry, the funding, again, for the women's apprenticeships. Again, the funding difference really here is the funding source. The funding amount is the same. And then finally, the Senate has an additional $24,000 beginning in fiscal year 2015 for the additional compliance and enforcement activities that relate to the Nursing Mothers Program.
There are questions from members on the spreadsheet.
Yes.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair Moon. Just very quickly, when this came up in the House floor and we looked at the special revenue of $37,000, did we clear up the double counting? Is that still?
Madam Chair and Representative Kreisha, yes, it was. I can get you a copy of the Senate fiscal note. There was a discrepancy when it came to the House floor, but that was cleared up in the Senate fiscal note.
And so?
Representative Kreisha.
And so that's cleared up here on the spreadsheet?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think we'll go to testimony at this time. And first on our list, we have Deborah Fitzpatrick from the University of Minnesota.
Before we move, Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Crescia.
And I was just, you had mentioned this, and I'm sorry, I'm a little slow on the uptake. On line 19.14 and 19.15, do we have a clear definition, or are you going to bring one of familial relationship? I think we talked about the other term, the family caregiver, but did you mention what the definition of familial relationship is going to be? And again, I'm sorry, I was a little slow on that one.
Representative Crescia, I'd have to pull up what the current definition of familial status is, which may have familial defined. I just don't remember off the top of my head.
Familial status is right there.
Yeah, Representative Crescia,
yep.
Familial status is defined in 363A.03. Subdivision 18. Familial relationship is used throughout Minnesota statute, but from my understanding isn't defined in Minnesota statute of what a familial relationship is. So maybe we can work on further defining what that is.
Okay, good. That'll help because I want to make sure thank you. That's a big help.
Ms. Fitzpatrick. Well, how about the testifiers? Just state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Kim Borton, and I'm the Director of Programs for the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to speak before the committee and for your work to align the legislation within each of these bills. On behalf of the Foundation and the Coalition for the Women's Economic Security Act and our thousands of members across Minnesota, we thank you all for being champions for Minnesota women and families. We applaud your leadership and the leadership of all bill authors to pass the Women's Economic Security Act of 2014. As you know, the act represents the first time in state history that policymakers, Republicans and Democrats alike, have prioritized a comprehensive approach to women's economic opportunity as the key to overall security within Minnesota. The Women's Foundation is thrilled to be a key partner in this work. We invest in statewide grant making, conduct research, drive public policy, and build women's philanthropy. In our research, the status of women and girls in Minnesota, in partnership with the Center of Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey Institute, has served as the basis for this legislation. And our research helps us understand what's occurring in the lives of women and girls in every region of the state. It focuses our grant making and our public policy agenda. And through our work, we've learned from our grantee partners and citizens across Minnesota that they're connected and concerned about the lack of well-paying jobs and the gender wage gap. We know that elderly and aging women are experiencing invisible poverty, and overall, Minnesotans report about the lack of opportunities that they have, women who need hope and access to resources in order to move their lives forward. And in previous testimonies, you all have heard me talk about Ginger, a single mom of two who lives in northern Minnesota. And when she arrived at Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, she was a high school dropout, worked a minimum wage job, and had little hope for her future. But now after receiving training and graduating from the agency's welding program, a program we fund, she landed a job in her field that pays Ginger $20 an hour plus benefits. Moms like Ginger across Minnesota need support for themselves and their families, and the Women's Economic Security Act does just that. It'll provide Ginger and other women with more access to higher wage jobs, wage disclosure protections, pregnancy and nursing accommodations, employment opportunities, as well as the many other supports included in this. And as a soon-to-be mom myself, this act will help me too. Because of the Women's Economic Security Act, we'll have pathways to prosperity, not pathways to poverty. At the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, that we know that when women thrive, so do their families and their communities. The Women's Economic Security Act and the bills before you today help women like Ginger and me and all communities across our state. So thank you for your consideration and hard work to make this happen.
Thank you, Ms. Borden, for your testimony. I appreciate that. And I think, you know, going forward, if we could have the testifiers for the purpose of conference committee try to stick to the differences between the House and Senate versions and what provisions you would prefer and why, of course, you would prefer those provisions, and try to narrow down our testimony to get aimed at that point.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Griffin, Moline, and I are worried that we're going to get called up to the floor to vote. And so we want to be sure we get as much input from you as possible.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Rosen has bills coming up.
Madam Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I direct the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey School. And I'd like to spend just a few minutes of your time today digging in a little deeper on the issue of the motherhood penalty and how the caregiver discrimination provisions in this House bill would address that. Across a number of studies using different methodologies, we see that mothers experience status-based discrimination. They are offered fewer workplace rewards because they are stereotyped as less competent and less committed to their jobs. We've heard a lot about how women don't need the state's help. Presumably, if they work hard or harder, they will be equally rewarded. Unfortunately, the research shows that mothers in the workplace face a double bind. Because stereotypes raise doubts about their workplace commitment, mothers are seen as violating the ideal worker norm that employees should display intense commitment to their jobs and always be there for their employer. Mothers who exert heroic efforts at work to avoid these stereotypes about their workplace commitment violate, unfortunately, competing a gender norm that mothers should prioritize family over paid work. As a result, mothers are either viewed as less competent or less committed to paid work, or are seen as less likable and less warm. Either way, the result is the same: lower pay and fewer promotions. Now, researchers such as Shelley Carell at Stanford and many others have studied a variety of potential solutions and find that legal mandates hold the most promise. Laws not only affect society through consequences, but also send critically important messages about what is appropriate in our state and what we value as a state. You have a chance in this bill to help the state of Minnesota create a new norm that recognizes the realities of our economy and family life in 2014. Men and women must both work and take care of their families. By adopting House language that prohibits discrimination based on caregiver status, you validate the heroic efforts that most Minnesotans make every day to do right by both their employer and their families, and you create a floor of fairness. At a minimum, workers with caregiving responsibilities should not be treated worse because they are taking responsibility for their families as well as their finances. Other provisions in the bill, like the nursing mothers, family leave, and pregnancy accommodation provisions, also help to create new norms and a statement about what we value as a state. Pregnant and nursing mothers are an important part of our workplaces and our workforce, and obviously the foundation, the literal genesis of our families. These portions of the bill need to have real and proportionate remedies. I urge you to accept the House enforcement sections for these parts of the bill. And before I turn it over, I'd like to switch gears for a minute and address the questions that were raised about the reporting requirements around the non-traditional workforce program. As you know, and as was mentioned, Representative Mahoney and Senator Bonoff have a separate bill that's looking at workforce programs, indeed, and the kinds of reports that are done related to that work. However, in looking at that language, I'm concerned that this issue of workforce segregation and its connection to the pay gap really isn't quite addressed there. And so I'm working with DEED to develop some changes to the current Senate language, which will accomplish the reporting goals. And I encourage the committee to adopt this new study language if possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. And next on the list, Mary Jo George from the AARP.
I forgot to tell you.
Welcome. If you want to state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair. Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to testify, and we also would like to thank both you, Representative Moline, and Senator Pappas for authoring this legislation. We think it does much to support family caregivers in the workplace as they balance their family caregiving duties with their work duties. In particular, just to limit my testimony, I did want to draw attention to the language in the House bill that provides equal protection for family caregivers. This is something that we strongly support, and we believe this provision would send a strong signal to employers and employees that family caregiving discrimination is not allowed in Minnesota. We think that it's very important to note that this provision is not requesting or requiring employers to offer special treatment of family caregivers. Rather, it would just simply require employers to treat workers with caregiving responsibilities the same way that we treat other employees. Thus, we would urge the Senate conferees to consider accepting this language because we think it would make a good bill even better. And I think one of our concerns is that we know as the labor force and the work for, aging population, we know more and more people are having to do this elder care responsibility, and this changing demographic is resulting in the potential for further discrimination on the job. We are, however, open to clarifying or further definition of the familial status or the family caregiver status. We're okay with the definition that was passed in the Senate bill that really defined who is a family caregiver. So with that, just one final remark is that I know we've heard that some people say that this would make Minnesota an island. That is not true. There are several states that already have this protection in law, and as many as 67 local units of government across 22 states do have this protection, including St. Paul. So thank you for that.
Are there questions from members for Ms. George? Seeing none, thank you. Brian Elliott. Mr. Elliott, if you want to state your name for the record and proceed.
Certainly. Brian Elliott with the Service Employees International Union. Thank you again, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today and for your work on behalf of this very important bill. As a union, one of the few majority women unions in the state, and a union that represents not only long-term care providers, but others who work with seniors and the elderly and with families who are facing retirement and are trying to make their way through retirement, I'm here to just to speak briefly about the differences between the two retirement security study provisions on R15 through R17 of the side-by-side. As Mr. Fuller and Shepard mentioned, the primary difference between the two bills is the appropriation, and because we feel that all of these topics are very important topics that we study. We heard in committee about the retirement security crisis and the importance of finding a solution to helping people save more of their own money for retirement. We support the Senate provision for $750,000, which was the management and budget estimate of the cost of studying all of these topics. However, recognizing that the estimate by management and budget was at the result of a request to one of the possible vendors about what this might cost, and their response was that they were unclear about exactly what the cost of studying all these topics might be. We actually do prefer the House language, the structure of the study in the House, which prioritizes those topics for which research is less available in the field at this time. If, however, we were able to see this bill come out of this committee with an appropriation in between the two amounts, the two recommendations that I would make for changes to the House language would be on page R16. Item number 3 on both sides. In the Senate, all topics are required topics. This topic dealing with the barriers and issues that prevent people from saving for retirement is in the optional list in the House bill, and I would recommend, and SEIU would recommend, moving that important topic into the required topics of study. And furthermore, at the top of page R17, item 13 in the Senate bill, dealing with policy options for discouraging employers from dropping existing coverage should the state decide to offer a state-administered retirement savings plan, much as we do a college savings plan. That topic was removed entirely from the House language because it was added as a as part of the definition of the plan in the very beginning of page R15. But should there be additional money beyond the $300,000 appropriated by the House, I would recommend adding that back into the optional topics of study in the House language as well.
Questions from members for Mr. Elliott, Representative Carisha.
And thank you, Chair Moline. Mr. Elliott, very quickly, and this came through State Gov Finance. The object of this is to prepare a report to come back to the legislature to make a decision on.
Correct.
Would either one of these provide adequate information to make that decision, in your opinion?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, members, yes, these reports would. The intent is between the intent of the structure in the House bill is to answer as many of these questions as possible, given the appropriation, and recognizing that the necessary appropriation is still approximate. And so the topics of study that are optional in the House language, as opposed to required in the Senate language, are those topics that are available in academic research currently and can be discovered through – can be included in a report through a look at the current academic research, as opposed to looking at current diving into new research based on Minnesota information and statistics.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott.
Thank you.
Next, we have Elaine Wyatt. Welcome. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed.
Elaine Wyatt, Executive Director of Women Venture. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I wanted to start by thanking all of you for supporting our work through annual deed funding. Through this support, last year we were able to start 194 businesses, create 307 new jobs, $4.6 million in salaried income, and nearly $8 million in gross sales. We are proud that our clients' businesses paid their employees an average of $20 an hour in 2013. Although women's businesses are growing rapidly, there is still disparity in Minnesota, where only a third of the businesses are led by women. Even greater disparity lies in revenue growth of women-owned firms, where Minnesota ranks 32nd in the country. That's where I'll stop my formal remarks and talk about the differences between the two bills. One of the concerns that we have is the difference in the House bill, where it requires the businesses to generate salaries of 200% of the federal poverty line, versus, and that's in the House versus 150 in the Senate. Looking at what we have been able to produce in our with our businesses, which is the average of $20 an hour, and then to think about in other parts of the state where I think at 200 it's about $23 an hour. I think that would be a very challenging mandate at this time to create businesses that could pay at that level. The other concern that I have is the question about whether it's a direct appropriation to Women Venture and the other women's designated Women's Business Center in the state, or whether or not it's a competitive grant. In all honesty, when we put this forward, what we did is look nationally at states that were actually addressing this problem in a very systematic way. because right now we really haven't found a way to create these kinds of businesses. So in my view, I would advocate for the state to really look towards other states and models. What we really believe is an exciting model is the Activate program that was developed in Maryland. And it's a very systematic approach. And so what I would be concerned about, whether the money came to Women Venture or to any other organization, is that we don't dilute the funds, but that we really create a pilot project that we could really test a model that's deemed to be effective and therefore really impact the whole state by bringing that model, if it's effective, and rolling it out more holistically.
Thank you, Ms. Wyatt. And could you explain to the committee what areas of the state do you serve currently?
Right now, we primarily work in the greater metro, and we do a small amount of work, but not any farther south than Mankato. So that's really our geography at this time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Ms. Wyatt, I was a little confused by your statement as to whether you like the House or the Senate approach. It wasn't clear to me.
Right.
Did you think that there were other women's business centers out there who you want to be able to apply for the grant, or did you think that there's only these two?
It was never our suggestion to define the two women's business centers that came out of the House. What I'm advocating for is an effective model, whether it's the two women's and there's only two in the state that would launch that, or if it's another entity. To me, I really want to advocate for a model that is actually effective that could address this issue. That's really, I am concerned about a grant application because I think it would dilute the funds. It would be wrong of me to advocate for the line item for Women Venture would seem self-serving. I'm not suggesting that we're necessarily the ones, but the two women's business centers are designated by the SBA to work with women. We have done most of that work in the state, and if we were selected, I think could have the most success. But
so, Madam Chair, we could write the language to say women's business centers designated by the SBA, and that would be flexible enough so that if there was a third one, that they would also be eligible.
So, Ms. Wyatt, are you saying that you're the only two in the state right
we
now?
Are.
That
we are. We are, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not to challenge my lead senator here, but I think there's some other.
It's just an idea.
It's just, okay. I'm not tied. There's two women's business centers, and you just tie the language to that. That eliminates a lot of great possibilities out there. And as I said, there are other initiative foundations. I have the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation that reaches out for either early childhood to business development. This is something they would probably love to get their hands around, and they could really get into that greater Minnesota to programs and to people that would jump on a program like this, absolutely. So I just fear limiting the language to just two possibilities, even though, as I said, if it was the Initiative Foundation or some other foundation that has been doing work with business development, if they don't have a specific women's program, I think we're really short selling ourselves on this program.
Ms. Wyatt, just for clarity, you said that you haven't served anything south of Mankato.
Right.
But there's nothing that precludes you from serving south of Mankato. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have the ability to serve the entire state of Minnesota within our mandate.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, what does that mean by how do you perform your outreach? Is it something that people come to you? Do you outreach to? Sorry, can you explain just a little bit more about the Women's Venture and how do you do that?
Ms. Wyatt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, currently our geography is focused and our marketing is focused on the greater metro, and that's the work that we do today we do have in our strategic plan to reach out to other parts of the community and really primarily south in respect for the other women's business center in the state, which really works St. Cloud and north. And so we would, we would expand south in our work. And our work is really focused on partnerships. So if there are existing economic development organizations in a community, what we often can bring is the capital to the table to help women start businesses in partnership with others.
And then, Ms. Wyatt, doesn't Northeast Entrepreneur Fund, don't they primarily only serve northeastern Minnesota?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my understanding was that they serve communities from St. Cloud North. That's my understanding. But
Ms. Nguyen, do you know? I guess I am a little bit concerned that basically we are kind of leaving southern Minnesota and northwestern Minnesota, possibly central Minnesota, out. From my understanding, I thought the Northeast Entrepreneurial Fund only served really northeastern Minnesota, and I thought Women Ventures was more statewide. But if it's more metro-centric, then I do think we'd probably be leaving out some communities.
Well, Madam Chair, we also have to be realistic in terms of how much money we're putting into this program. It's not, you know, really designed to be a statewide program. There's not enough money here yet.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, and to the testifier, maybe I can ask this, because Senator Pappas, you hit it right on the head. We have a limited amount of resources, and the other thing we're looking for is expediency. And so my concern is, hypothetically, if you were to take this on, because of your network, would your first 12 months have to be focused in greater metro, or would you be able to reach a wider network within that time frame?
Ms. Wyatt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we would focus our work in our current network because that's where we would be able to achieve the goals that are laid out within the grant because those are where our connections lie today.
Thank you for that.
Any other follow-up from members? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Wyatt.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And just a comment, I would hate to exclude a wonderful project or business opportunity just because of a geographic location. You know, that would be very sad. So there was an opportunity to make sure that it's expanded.
Thank you,
there's
Senator
opportunities
Rosen.
For all women across the state.
I agree. I think we're in the situation where we don't have a lot of money, and we want to make sure that it is organizations that have a track record of making sure that, you know, they can meet the criteria and accomplish what we're trying to accomplish with the statute, which I think opening it up, you know, you do open yourself up to the possibility of giving grant money to an organization that doesn't have that sort of track record, which I think then wouldn't result in what we're trying to accomplish with the language. At the same time, you know, I too don't want to be tying our hands so much that we would be leaving out portions of greater Minnesota, which I actually think see more disparity in income between men and women than even the metro area does, although we know that the disparity is statewide. So I agree, maybe we can figure out some sort of language to address that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
But I think perhaps the Senate language is actually does not limit, you know, to a specific group, but leaves up to the commissioner to work with the, perhaps we can change just, or maybe tweak it just a little bit to include other business development programs, but just an idea.
Thank you. Representative Cresha.
And thank you. And I think this is a very important conversation. We have it all the time as well. But one of the other sides that I'll offer is, because as Senator Pappas highlighted, we have limited resources, I think it's also equally important that we find a good project and we get a good project up and running so that we can use that for a basis for around the state too. I would hate for our conversation to be more around who are we leaving out when we could be also saying who do we get up quickly so that we can model for the rest of the state. So I think there's going to be a fine balance on this, and I think we'll have to look at it very carefully.
And I guess the one other comment I would have is regarding the income levels. It sounded like the Women Ventures preferred the Senate language, which was the jobs created had to be 150% of the poverty line. The House language is 200%. I mean, you know, I personally am more comfortable with the 200% because I think if we're putting state money behind it and our goal is to get women into higher income jobs, it'd be a shame to only go 150% of the poverty line, which is not that much. So I think we need to consider, you know, what kind of jobs are we creating here? Do we want to do 200% of the poverty line or do we want to do 150% of the poverty line? I don't even know off the top of my head what those two numbers would be, but...
She said $20 and $23 an hour.
For the jobs that they create now.
I thought she said that was 150 and 200.
Maybe if could this way come back up just to clarify that. Oh.
Depends on family size, right?
Okay, so under the federal poverty lines, family of four, 150% of the federal poverty guideline would be $35,775 annually, and 200% would be $47,700. So, I mean, 150% for a family of four at only $35,775, that's just not that high, in my opinion. But maybe if Ms. Wyatt, you could add clarity to the issues that there would be that you found in your work on trying to go up to the 200% level.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we measure the income of the women that are running the businesses as well as the income that they're paying their employees directly. So I guess I didn't read it with the family of four. So we were looking really at the $17 an hour versus $23 an hour for the employees within the businesses. So that's pretty similar to what you were saying. It's just that we look at it as the individual person's income versus what the whole family is being paid.
So then for a family of one, so the individual's income, 150% would be only $17,500. 200% would be $23,340. I guess that'll just be a question for the committee on, you know, what kind of jobs we want to create with this money, so everyone's aware of what the numbers are. Are there any other questions from members? Thank you, Ms. Wyatt. Patty Tangi.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Patty Tangi, and I'm president of the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota. We are a statewide organization of organizations and individuals who are passionate about addressing the gender wage gap. And we do this by ensuring our current local and state pay equity laws remain strong and intact. And we see that the equal pay provisions in this bill are one yet another tool in the toolkit to help shrink the gender wage gap. So specifically, there are five provisions that we would really like to see retained in the final version of this bill. Number one being the House language on lines 918 through 928, which refers to the average compensation for its female employees, is not consistently below the average compensation for male employees within major EEO-1 job categories. So EEO-1 job categories most businesses are familiar with these categories, and they include official and managers, professionals, technicians, sales workers, administrative support workers, craft workers, operatives, laborers and helpers, service workers. And we think those pretty much cover the gamut for contractors. We also like this language because it allows us to take a look at the pay differences specifically within broad job classes instead of individual job titles. The phrase consistently below, as it's applied in state and local government for the Pay Equity Act, Local Government Pay Equity Act and the State Government Pay Equity Act, means that women cannot be paid below the average pay for men more than 20% of the time, or in more than 20% of the jobs in the EEO-1 categories as in this bill. So, of course, there are reasons why this may not be the case, and that is listed also on 9.21 in the House version. So things like length of service, requirements for specific jobs, experience, skill, effort, responsibility, working conditions of the job, and other mitigating factors may be permissible in this regard. So the second provision that we would like to see retained is in the Senate language, line 7.24 to 7.35. And that specifically describes describing briefly the practices used to set wages that will give public insight into possible causes of the earnings gap. A truly equitable compensation system would take into consideration a myriad of factors. We simply must begin paying women for what they do and the results that they bring to their companies, and not just simply by bias-ridden market-based salary surveys. Thirdly, we would like to see the language in the final version of the House in lines 10.1 to 10.18, identifying items that the commissioner may request for an audit. This information is helpful for businesses to know what they need to do to provide equitable compensation, and it clarifies to them what the commissioner is going to ask for in the future should they be audited. The fourth thing that we would like to see retained is the House language found on lines 11.10. We believe it's time to move quickly into the enforcing of our current statutes, and don't think we need to wait any longer than August of this year to get moving on that. And lastly, we would like to see the Senate version, line 9.3 to 9.10, remain so that, because we would like to see a report to the elected officials every 2 years and not just a one-time situation. We have some experience with the Local Government Pay Equity Act reporting every year, and we don't think that this would be cumbersome for the Department of Human Rights to report every other year. So those are the provisions that we would love to stay in the final versions. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tangi. Are there any questions for Ms. Tangi or about the provisions that she pointed out? Representative Kresha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Tangi, you had mentioned, and I just want to make sure I get this right, the audit portion, which language did you want? And that was...
So in the audit version...
R11, 10.1 to 10.18.
Correct. On the House side.
Anything else?
Okay, so if I could.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned that you would like to see that language retained because you thought it would offer more insight for businesses. Did you have businesses coming to you requesting that, or are you just, is that something that you believe?
Something that we've noticed in our 30-year experience with the Local Government Pay Equity Act, what we kind of need to know what's happening in wage-setting practices to make some movement in the future towards making sure that the practices are equitable. Does that help answer your question? So no businesses in particular.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering for. So we haven't had businesses actually come. So this is out of your 30-year experience.
Right.
But you haven't necessarily had a business come and say, hey, this is the structure that would be helpful for us as we go forward.
No, not for businesses. But okay. We do know that there is, you know, there are many different ways that businesses come to the wages that they decide that they're going to pay, and that's through a myriad different analyses.
And thank you. And so thank you. That's helpful because I just want to make sure, I mean, the work that I've done with women-owned businesses as they're trying to come forward. I want to make sure that we're putting something in front of them that makes them the most successful possible. So
absolutely.
Thank you.
Any more questions for Ms. Tangi? All right. Thank you very much. Then next we have Lisa Stratton from Gender Justice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of this committee. My name is Lisa Stratton. I'm a co-founder of Gender Justice, which is a nonprofit law firm based here in St. Paul, with a simple mission, which is eliminating gender barriers, whether they be in law or policy. And I want to start by thanking all of you for the work you've done. This is a very exciting moment for people who've dedicated their work to creating equality in the workplace and elsewhere. It's an honor to be part of the process. I am planning to address several of the workplace-related differences between the two bills. What I bring to that, just so that you know, is expertise in employment law. I have been a litigator and a practitioner of employment law for over 15 years. And what gender justice brings is the words and stories of women who come to our office who are seeking counsel for violations of their rights or things they feel are unfair based on their gender at work. And I'm going to focus on three areas: the nursing mothers section that we've discussed differences, the pregnancy accommodations, and the last one I'd like to say something about at the end is the wage disclosure, the protection for conversations about wages. And I think if I went in order of the way the comparison, which I should probably do, has been done, we would start with pregnancy. And the major difference there between, you know, there are a number of minor ones that could be discussed, but the major difference is this concept of the undue burden defense and the role that it plays. And
good timing for you to be here.
I think the coalition supporting the bill believes it is not necessary to add the undue burden language to all of the provisions in the bill. The bill itself is intended to allow to give a message to employers that they need to accommodate very sort of temporary, normal needs of a pregnant woman in the workplace. And it's to avoid what's being termed nationally the pregnancy push-out. That is this phenomenon that when women become pregnant and need some minor changes in their workplace, like the things that are listed in the statute, access to food or water or a restroom more frequently, minor changes in their job, they often are met with hostility and denials and end up having to leave, either leave early and use family and medical leave, or just are denied and have to work through without the accommodations, endangering their health. And there are examples from around the country of women ending up with kidney infections and, you know, serious dehydration and negative effects on their pregnancies, which none of us want. So that was the purpose here. These are simple common sense steps. So the more that we add on burdens on a woman who's just seeking them and concepts that employers, legal concepts to raise that no one knows what they mean, is much more fitting to, say, an Americans with Disabilities Act or ADA disability framework than the framework we're creating here. The Americans with Disabilities Act uses that framework of undue burden or hardship defenses, and though the kinds of accommodations that are needed there are generally more permanent, not always, but they tend to be more permanent, more costly, and not of this sort of simple common sense nature. So we prefer the House version pregnancy-related accommodations. And unless there are any questions about any of the other more minor differences or about that, I would go on to nursing. Okay.
Are there questions from members on that piece? Senator Sieben?
Madam Chair, and Ms. Stratton, will you just clarify that I believe that you support the undue burden language is different than the structure of the two bills compared to the House and Senate have different ways they structure their pregnancy bills. So could you, or maybe you were going to get to that, but if not, could you address how the language reads in the structure?
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Thank you, Madam Chair. The bills aren't that different in terms of the actual content and the effect. I mean, I think I highlighted the one major substantive difference. There is this difference in the way that they're structured. you can do everything but this, or you know, you can not do X, Y, and Z. It's a bit hard to compare. They look very different, but in the bottom line, I don't think they are terrifically different. I think the Senate structure is easier to basically read and follow, but that the House structure is also understandable. So I'm almost agnostic on that point, Senator Sieben. I think it. I think your counsel and I'd be happy to provide input can help craft something that melds them in a way that makes it understandable.
Senator Sieben?
No, I think, thank you. Ms. Stratton, I was just curious, as a practitioner, we want to make mm-hmm. sure that our intent is very clear. So if you think both versions work, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah. I think in the interest of time, you know, you could talk about pros and cons of either one, but I do think they both reach the same result.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Stratton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the nursing law, this is an area that covers the last two topics, which is what is the nature of a remedy? When this legislature adopted a law, very forward-thinking, in 1998, that told employers that they should allow a woman who's returning to the workplace and maybe nursing a child who needs to express milk at work, that they should give short breaks and time space, clean space to do that where possible. But as we discovered at Gender Justice, when our client Tara Duncan, who some of you have met in the course of talking about this bill, and she's testified before several committees, she found, and when she came to us and we went to the law, we realized there's no remedy. So the gap that we were trying to fill with this piece of WISA is to create a remedy. And now the ultimate, now that we are at this stage, the dispute is, or the difference between the two bills is what should the nature of that remedy be. We request that the committee look very seriously at the House position there, the House remedy, because it points toward the Minnesota Human Rights Act and the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And I understand that the commissioner is here and will testify also. So I don't want to spend too much time on things that he could clarify. But that process, here, I will tell you as a practitioner how and why I value that process. One, it includes an informal process. The department is involved, but you're not preparing a complaint and going before a judge and going to court. You are just preparing a simple, plain language statement of the alleged violation, and you send it to the department. And that's really it. Provide some jurisdictional information. It can be as short as a paragraph. The employer then has a limited period of time, which I think is especially key with this nursing law, that it be addressed very quickly in order to avoid it becoming an unsolvable problem if the woman can't continue, either has to leave the job to continue nursing or ends up giving up that in order to stay on the job. So promptness is important. The department takes that and sends it to the employer, and they have a set period, a short period of time in which to respond, but it's equally informal. They don't have to have a lawyer. They don't have to prepare pleadings like a formal court filing. They just do the same thing. They tell their side of this story. The department then either or both assigns an investigator or asks both parties if they're interested in an informal resolution. At that stage, many of the Human Rights Department complaints are resolved. And the contrast with what is in the Senate version, which is just a separate civil action, means that in each case, that would be really the only remedy. There is no quick, easy, informal remedy by a department that's job is to ensure equal opportunity in the workplace.
Ms. Stratton?
Yes?
Maybe I missed it, but did you clarify on which provision you preferred for the nursing mothers?
I was hoping to say that the Minnesota Department of Human Rights enforcement mechanism, which is the House position,
okay.
is the better solution for the practical reasons I'm outlining.
Are you aware at all in your practice of being able to, a little bit earlier we were talking about the Senate language for nursing mothers, and there's an enforcement provision, but outside of that enforcement provision, there's no remedy provided for under 181 unless you specify it in the statute. And there was a suggestion that perhaps you could bring a claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act for gender discrimination in addition to this enforcement provision. Are you aware in your practice of a nursing mother being able to bring a gender discrimination claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act?
Madam Chair, I am not aware of any state law cases. Perhaps the commissioner has seen complaints and could speak to that. I am aware of federal cases that deal with that issue, and they have been split. And in the majority of cases, courts have found that nursing is not related to pregnancy, surprisingly enough, or sex. And so it is not considered, because we treat all nursing people the same. So it's not a gender issue. And it's not pregnancy per se. So neither of those categories get protection for denials or discrimination for even asking about rights to nursing. That has been the case at federal appellate circuit courts of appeals. So that is exactly the problem this is trying to remedy.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
There have been reported cases of men nursing. So I think the courts are right on there.
As long as they treat them the same. I had seen those caregivers.
That was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
It happens in... Himself. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm speaking out of turn. Sorry.
Ms. Stratton.
Oh, I was just going to add in support of the caregiver piece, which I am not addressing, but that the same thing happens there when the suggestion is made that sex discrimination law is the solution for many of these issues. These have been specifically identified as gaps, and the caregiver one is the same kind of gap where the courts have said to male plaintiffs who have tried to brought claims, very obvious claims, that they are being treated differently because they are a caregiver for a spouse or a child. And courts have specifically looked and said, well, they treat women very badly at this, too. So that is not a sex discrimination claim. Similar kind of just drawing an analogy to that caregiver bill, which is so important, I think, to all the advocates here.
Okay.
And I do want to retract. I did misspeak, though, when I was talking about civil right of action, so I may have confused you all inadvertently. It's the nursing mother's enforcement mechanism that's there is a particularly, in our view, unhelpful one from a woman's perspective. It is not the private civil action. You're correct that Mr. Fuller intimated that could be, you know, a scenario. There could be a scenario in which that could happen. No? Well, I apologize if I misunderstood. But for the nursing mothers, it is just the fine. It is just write a letter to the Department of Labor.
I think what Mr. Fuller had said was that there was no other civil remedy provided for it because we weren't providing it in statute, but presented the scenario that there could possibly be a claim under the Human Rights Act, which maybe we can get more information from the commissioner on whether or not there have been state complaints or not in that regard. But I think we're all in agreement that the only remedy available under the Senate provision for the nursing mothers would be the enforcement provision that's set forth.
And Madam Chair, may I continue? Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Under that enforcement scheme, just to be clear, I think you all know this as lawmakers, but the fine would go to the state, and so it doesn't provide anything to a woman who has been harmed by the violation. And in the nursing scenario, although the burdens are fairly minimal to provide a small space and time, the effect on the woman is dramatic. And I know our time doesn't permit us to hear from all the many women who've testified along the way, but the enforcement issue does not come up, does not get to the point of needing a formal remedy unless the woman has either lost her job, she's either been fired for asking, or has sort of, we call it constructive discharge in the law, she's decided that she's going to leave the job in order to be able to nurse, or she's economically not in a position to do that and has given up on nursing in order to keep her job and support her family. So these, although it sounds like a small thing, and it is in the sense of burdens on employers, the damage that can be done when the law is violated is serious. It's either very serious economic harm, or it is a bonding and health benefit for your child that you can never recapture. So I think it is important that there be a robust remedy. And we've had this law now since 98 without any at all. And the purpose of this bill was to create one that was meaningful and that gave a remedy to women.
Are there other questions for members on the nursing accommodations provision? Ms. Stratton, were you going to talk about other provisions as well?
I was going to speak briefly along the same lines to the difference between the two, the House and Senate enforcement provisions, again, on the wage disclosure law. That would be helpful. The purpose of this law, again, just to bring us back to the big picture quickly and very hopefully succinctly, that over 60% of employees in the private sector report that they are barred either by a formal policy or strongly discouraged from talking about their wages or salary or compensation. And that is an impediment, a major impediment, to enforcement of the equal pay laws. And by that we mean same pay for same job. If you work on a line, for example, and you are not allowed, if your company policy says you could be disciplined or terminated just for sharing how much you make an hour with the worker right next to you, that is the most common scenario now. And that is not under current law illegal in any way. So this bill is designed to allow those conversations to happen in the workplace, to allow Joe to talk to Mary about what he makes an hour and her to do the same. And if there's a problem, to be able to bring it to the human rights, they're usually human relations or personnel departments, and say, I see this anomaly. Can we do something? I mean, that's really the bottom line. And most employers would then address it or explain it. So the issue is what kind of remedy for violations, again, of this statute. So where the employer has taken some kind of adverse action, has fired an employee, has disciplined an employee for the discussion of wages to be a violation of this statute, what options does the employee have to show this violation and what remedies might they have? And the contrast here is, again, that full range of remedies, informal and formal, through the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. That's the House version, and that is the version that the coalition prefers for many of the same reasons I outlined about the advantages of the Department of Human Rights process. And the Senate version... the Senate version looks to Chapter 181 in the Department of Labor, but... In it simply allows for a civil cause of action. So any woman who wanted to, or anyone, this isn't just gender specific, anyone who wants to say they were prevented from a basic conversation with a coworker about their wages and is fired or disciplined enough to want to redress would have to go to court, would have to file, spend, you know, $325 or $400 some, depending on state, federal court, to bring that lawsuit, hire probably a lawyer, which most people cannot afford to do, and pursue it that way. There isn't an agency kind of process without the Department of Human Rights under the remedies it's been as it's now stands in the Senate version.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Stratton, it seems to me that the coalition's preference for the Department of Human Rights is not so much on a philosophical argument that this is a human rights violation, however we define that, a violation of someone's human rights, but more on the argument that they have a simple process where things can be quickly addressed, informal, no needs for lawyers, you know, just more remedies than are available under at the Department of Labor and Industry.
Ms. Stratton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is our argument. And that is the most practical argument one could make. It's probably the most important. As speaking as gender justice, I could absolutely make the case to you that there is also a philosophical reason for that preference, which is that the Department of Human Rights is about equal opportunity in the workplace, and that these aspects of women's experience in the workplace are all the underlying purpose is to get at that equality. But whether that be the case or not, the bottom line is the remedy needs to be meaningful. The remedy needs to include some kind of informal process, some kind of process where a person can get fairly quick resolution, quick response from the employer at least, and then advocate for herself, or a department that could have the enforcement powers to help with that as the process went on. And in the very serious cases where there's been a job loss and serious economic harm, a remedy of a court case if needed, but that would be a last resort for, as I advise anyone, I've always worked with workers and I've always advised to use every process you can, starting with a letter, before you bring a court claim.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Stratton, for bringing that information in. You brought up the hypothetical situation of the line workers, and I just want to make sure I understand that. So two line workers talking or two employees, but I'll use your example. If they're having a conversation and they disclose the wage and they shouldn't have, do they have any protections right now under the, would be the National Labor Relations?
Some employees might have some protections under the National Labor Relations Act, but there is for an entire set of reasons that can be very difficult to do. It's very time consuming. Costly, moves very, very slowly, and it has limited application. It's only to certain employers. It's only to employees who are, like I said, the line job. It would be one of the ones where that could apply because it's hourly workers only. So anyone that's paid on a salaried basis does not have protection under the National Labor Relations Act.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Chairman Lane. And, okay, so just for clarification, so when you say some the language that we would be proposing here that you're advocating for, that would protect the gap. There's some gaps. Is that?
Ms. Stratton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, exactly. There are gaps. The federal law really covers hourly workers from certain size businesses at that very macro level. There are also some defenses built into the National Labor Relations Act that speak about, you know, business reasons. And the courts have interpreted that so broadly that it is really not very effective for workers.
Any other questions?
Thank you. And so I guess now that I think about this, and thank you for your testimony, but are we going to be creating a situation where we're going to make it more complicated? Are we going to be too broad over the federal? It seems like we almost may be. It's just something I think we have to look at carefully because we may be causing a very complicated situation for our employees. Not understanding all of the, I mean, you do this on a daily basis as a practitioner, and it sounds like it suddenly becomes very complicated. Are we going to make it even more difficult?
Ms. Stratton.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I don't think it makes it more difficult. The NLRA is complicated. It's an entirely separate. I wouldn't call myself even a labor lawyer. After 15 years, I'm an employment lawyer, and the National Labor Relations Act is a whole world unto itself. So it's not particularly worker-friendly unless they're in a union. Yeah, I mean, unions know how to work in that environment, and that's really what it's predominantly for. Protections like this that extend beyond union workers are sort of because they get sort of covered at the fringes. And we would not be doing anything. Every single employment law really has a state and a federal, at least in Minnesota, a state and federal counterpart for the most part. So it is a very ordinary need to contrast state-federal law. We would not be the first state to have this kind of law. I like to say that Minnesota is always on the forefront on these issues, especially with equal pay, but we would not be the first. There are six other states that have a state law like this.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you. And just I'm sorry, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this, you can imagine. Would we be creating anything that – would the National Labor – would that supersede this anyway?
Ms. Stratton.
No, it would be, you know, a right could be pursued under either. It would not, okay. I'm not aware of it having been held to supersede, as you say, any of the other state laws.
Yes. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Ms. Stratton.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner Lindsay.
And Scott. I think Scott's on the list, too.
Is Commissioner Lindsay here?
Yeah, here.
Oh, okay. Welcome, Commissioner. If you could please state your name for the record. And
yes, my name is Kevin Lindsay. I am the Commissioner on the Minnesota Department of Human Rights.
And Commissioner, I don't know if you wanted to just sort of touch on a couple of the pieces that are under the purview now of the Department of Human Rights under either or both the House and Senate language, and then I'm sure members will have some questions as well.
Madam Chair, whatever your pleasure is, if you wish me to answer questions as relates to it, I know that there was some as relates to the process for the department. I'm happy to answer those, or if you want me to walk through the respective bill language.
Commissioner Lindsay, if you could just walk through the language to begin with that affects the department.
The equal pay certificate language. In lines 9.1 to 9.2 in the House bill includes an exemption for a parent or a subsidiary of the entity, as well as for the healthcare field contractors that are exempt. The Senate bill does not include this as an extended exemption. We believe that the House language would create an overly broad exemption that would undermine the purposes of the certification. We therefore recommend adopting the Senate language.
And could you clarify again what lines you're looking at?
Scope. Is it on page R9, that's section 5? Maybe the staff can help us.
9.1, 9.2.
On the House, but what's the corresponding Senate language?
Well, we don't have it.
Oh, I see.
There is no language within the Senate.
Okay.
The application criteria, the House language, focuses in again on what employers will not do. The Senate language is couched in more proactive language, specifying what employers will do to help female employees. The Senate draft does not include EEO-1 reporting. Therefore, as a department, we recommend adopting the Senate language, which also includes the EEO-1 reporting.
Can I just get clarity? Are you talking about subdivision? Let's see, subdivision 1? On the Senate bill, Section 5, Subdivision 1, just that first paragraph, and then the somebody help me out here. I'm not clear what he's talking about.
Mr. Fuller.
I believe he's referring to the list on the Senate side on R10,
right.
Paragraphs 1, 2, 3, there on 7.17. And he's saying he prefers that with the addition of the House language requiring EEO-1 reporting.
That's what I understood it as well. Yeah. So he prefers the Senate language on R10 7.17 through, is it 7.22? And then with the addition of the EEO-1 House language, which is on R9, paragraph 5. 9.18. So to add that to the
9.18 to 9.23.
Right. So to add this to the Senate.
Got it.
That's correct.
And then, excuse me, Madam Chair, Commissioner, then there was something on 9.1 and 9.1 and 9.2, that exemption that you thought was too broad or something?
Yeah, that's in the House bill.
Mm-hmm. Is that the whole, that's just part of a sentence. Does it go on longer than that? Is it the rest of the paragraph you're talking about, or?
No, specifically just the language, quote, a parent or subsidiary of the entity, close quote.
Okay. Great.
We're more concerned as it relates to broadening than as it relates to anyone which might have a subsidiary interest in the healthcare entity.
Thank you, Commissioner.
All right.
Are there other pieces in dealing with the equal pay provisions?
The House bill includes language on revocation of certificates of compliance, voiding of contracts, and administrative review outside of the equal pay section. That's found on lines 10.9 or 10.19 to 11.2. The Senate bill includes the subdivisions in the equal pay section on lines 8.5 to 8.27. This is just simply to note that this language is the product of a compromise between the Department of Human Rights and the Department of Administration.
What, Commissioner, could you clarify which, if it's the House or the Senate version, that's the compromise?
The Senate language represents the compromise which has been reached by the Department of Administration and the Department of Human Rights.
Then I have a question on that.
Sure.
Commissioner Lindsay, from my understanding, you currently have the authority to void a contract or revoke a certificate under the affirmative action portion of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. I'm just wondering, your authority under that, is that similar to the House language or Senate language, or is it just completely different?
Chairman Lean, members of this committee, what we have tried to do in working with the Department of Administration is to mirror the respective language which currently exists as relates to when we issue workforce certificates and when we can decide to revoke those certificates. So in the instance in which the certificate has been or in which a contract has been let between a bid awarding entity and a vendor in which they did not have a certificate, that provides an instance in which we can revoke the contract or amend that respective contract. Also, in a situation in which we find that the contractor has not engaged in good faith efforts under the administrative rules, we can suspend or revoke a contract in that instance. So those are the two instances in which the department has such authority.
And for the good faith effort language, which I see is in the Senate language and not in the House language, can you provide a sort of example of what would demonstrate or what would not demonstrate a good faith effort of compliance?
Madam Chair, members of this committee, typically what happens is that when we find deficiencies which have been, which have occurred by a contractor, we have a conversation with them. It's typically by the enforcement officer. If those deficiencies aren't remedied at that point in time, we will then issue a more formal deficiency letter, and it generally subjects the contractor at that point in time to either a meeting with the assistant commissioner and myself to ensure that our concerns have been clarified with the contractor. If at that point in time that the issues aren't remedied, we then may make a determination that the conduct is such that it warrants us taking an additional step to either suspend or revoke the contractor certificate. I have not gotten to a point in which we have not been able to resolve the situation with the contractor after I have sat down and met with the contractor.
Okay. And then on the Senate language has multiple violations as a requirement. It says, or has multiple violations in order for you to revoke the certificate. What is multiple, 2 or 7? Or what's your understanding of what a multiple violation would be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, multiple violations, as I look at this respective language and have thought about this respective language, could be as few as 2, or it could be as many as you have suggested, 7. It really depends on the severity of the particular deficiencies. In some instances, we find that, and I'll give you an example as it relates to the administrative rule, failing to communicate your equal employment policy and distributing that to all of your employees may constitute conduct which might fall short of good faith effort. That violation in and of itself probably is not going to warrant the department taking a stance of revoking or suspending your certificate. Failing to adequately address an investigation of discrimination and ensuring retaliation or allowing retaliation to occur by an employee may, on the other hand, subject you to having your certificate revoked or suspended. It just simply depends upon the conduct of the employer as to how we make that determination. Typically, when we have the first instance, the meeting, the resolution, and again, just to understand, the Human Rights Act asks us to conciliate respective findings of discrimination which we uncover. So the notion that we are initially going to try and resolve it short of taking a more drastic step is how the department is structured.
Are there questions from members on that portion of the equal pay provisions?
No.
Commissioner Lindsay, do you want to talk at all about the differences in the audit portions?
Yes, Madam Chair, I appreciate the question. The House bill has very specific guidelines for auditing, as I understand it, in lines 9.30 through 10.18. The Senate language is more concise and overarching, giving the Department of Human Rights more freedom and ability to audit more effectively. We therefore recommend that the Senate language be adopted as it provides more freedom to conduct audits to ensure compliance under the law. I know that there has been concern in other committees about the breadth of the ability for the department to exercise discovery. The department already is limited under the administrative rules as it relates to the breadth of discovery in which it contacts. And again, it's the same standard which exists under civil law, is that it has to be evidence which could be used in a proceeding or reasonably likely to lead to the discovery of evidence which we would use, which is the same standard which exists under civil law.
Are there questions from members on that piece? Commissioner Lindsay, I think the next piece that the department deals with would be pregnancy accommodations. Is that correct? We had some questions earlier regarding that.
And that can be found on R20.
And so, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's under 181 in both the House and the Senate versions.
Madam Chair, that is my understanding. It may be helpful. I've heard from Senate counsel that in the absence of any language, that a statute that is violated could support a finding of discrimination under 363A. And I do agree with that general proposition. I am, however, concerned as relates to the passage of the entirety of these bills as they are brought forward, specifically because of the language which is found on page R21, and specifically the language on the House side, 18.3 to 18.6, and then on the Senate side, 16.9 to 16.12. In both instances, the subdivision leads off with interaction with other laws. So to the extent that the legislature, in passing the entire package of the Women's Economic Security Act, makes mention of how that package of laws might interplay with other statutes, that may be subsequently interpreted by a court to suggest that it was not the intent of the legislature and that the exclusive remedy of the other provisions was to reside within 181. In my conversations with the two of you, I've not had that impression that that was the intent of the respective authors of this legislation. I would therefore recommend striking that respective language, which exists both at the House and the Senate.
And Commissioner Lindsay, I don't think that certainly was the intent of either author, and it was brought to my attention, I think this morning when you and I were talking about it, that we could possibly, by putting that into statute, be, or at least be providing the argument that we would be excluding a sex discrimination claim under the Human Rights Act. Mr. Fuller, did you want to?
Well, Madam Chair, I have the opposite conclusion. I thought the intent to put this in was to preserve your claims under other law. So it says nothing shall diminish any other law. So the argument would be, if you didn't have that in there, I suppose you could make the argument that was exclusive. It would be a weak argument. But usually when we put these sorts of things that say this law doesn't affect your rights under the law, the intent is to preserve the rights under the other law. So unless I'm missing something, nothing in this section shall be construed to affect any other provision of law relating to sex discrimination, meaning that the law stands as it is. And so I assume the argument would be, if it's not there, the law would not stand. You could make that argument. So I'm not following that line of reasoning.
So you're interpreting it the opposite of what the commissioner is.
Yes.
Madam Chair and Senate Counsel Fuller, I think the issue arises with the first clause, talking about affecting any other provision in the law, because that is a positive statement which suggests that the legislature considered the expansion of the law, is that since you have now enacted a law in the totality of the package, that you must have considered that issue.
Diminish. Would it work, Commissioner Lindsay, if we replace the word affect with diminish?
I think if you struck the language that nothing in this law shall be construed to affect any other provision.
Or, Commissioner Lindsay, if we put diminish instead of effect.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the best course of action is to strike the language. The second best course of action is to suggest that nothing shall be diminished.
Well, Commissioner Lindsay, currently, you must receive complaints of pregnant, related to pregnancy complainants try to bring under sex discrimination under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Is that true? What's your history with that, and can you successfully bring a pregnancy claim under sex discrimination under the Human Rights Act?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, the department does receive sex discrimination claims, and I have heard earlier testimony, so it may be helpful to give a little background as relates to this respective area of the law. As relates to sex discrimination claims on the basis of disparate treatment on the basis of the pregnancy, the charging party or the plaintiff has to establish that she would meet the definition of being a disabled person, as is typically interpreted under the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Minnesota Human Rights Act. That generally creates a substantial burden for that individual to proceed going forward in having the matter resolved favorably. There is a body of case law under Title VII and under the Minnesota Human Rights Act talking about transitory or minor complications. If a woman has a transitory or minor complication which is tied to her pregnancy, she is not able to bring a claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act or Title VII, its federal equivalent of anti-discrimination law. So to the extent that you wish to create protection for a woman for a definition of pregnancy discrimination, the House and the Senate language could do that under the current, or it could do that going forward as it is drafted. The challenge, I think, with the way that it is structured under 181 is it becomes a question of where that is filed and what happens if one of us passes on it as an administrative agency, the Department of Labor or the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Does the female employee have her right continue going forward? I think it would be cleaner and clearer if the definition was housed within 363A.
Steven, you're the only other member here. Do you have any questions?
I was just curious, Mr. Fuller, what would you think the practical implication would be of removing the language as Commissioner Lindsay suggested?
Mr. Fuller?
Senator Steven, Madam Chair, I think it could have an adverse effect. Usually these on the proponents of this section, because usually this is put in to safeguard pre-existing rights. So you say you have this pre-existing bundle of rights. Now we're addressing those rights in a different fashion. That does not change your bundle of rights previously existing. The chair's suggestion to maybe just keep in the diminished language, I think, has some attraction. To take it all out now, you have a legislative history now where it was in both bills, now it's in conference, and it's removed. Absent looking at the tapes, it looks like, well, now we intend to diminish. You know, the rights, that argument could be made. So I think one has to be very careful. And I just simply don't agree that it could limit other rights if you say nothing in this section will diminish it. It's common legislative language to put that in there by proponents of the new language to make sure that it doesn't diminish anything that preexisted or in the future. So that I'm just confused. I mean, I have to sort of absorb this, but that's my experience.
Mr. Fuller, it seems like you're saying then if we would adopt Representative Moline's suggestion that nothing shall be construed to diminish any other provision, that may clarify our intent and also address the concerns that Commissioner Lindsay raises.
Yes.
Well, and I think it's interesting that how difficult it is to make a pregnancy claim under gender or under sex discrimination under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. You would think that that would fit, being that only women can get pregnant, but it sounds like there's a lot of hurdles that a pregnant employee would have to make in order to accomplish bringing a successful gender discrimination claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which I think goes to the, you know, probably the overall intent of our bill, which is to clarify some of those areas of law. So that's helpful to know as well. Are there other questions from members on the pregnancy accommodation provisions? Okay. Senator Sieben.
Commissioner Lindsay, I don't know if you have really looked too closely at the way that House and Senate versions of the pregnancy accommodation sections are worded, or if you have any opinion on which language you prefer in terms of the way that it's read as a someone who will, well, if you have any input onto that, the way it's structured.
Senator Sieben, Chair Moline, and members of the committee, I can't provide information as relates to the additional provisions. I did want to mention one thing and follow up. to the extent that you adopt a provision of adding language in there shall not diminish, I think for consistency's sake, that any time that you are in this package creating new rights under 181, that you probably want to carry that language about not diminishing in the other provisions of the 181 statutes that you pass in this WISA package.
So, for example, under the nursing mothers?
Correct.
Okay.
I'm Chair Moline, members of the committee, that is correct.
And then could you answer Senator Stevens' question regarding the other language portions of the pregnancy accommodations, if you have an opinion on that?
Yes. As to the pregnancy accommodations, the nursing mothers, again, on the benefit of having sat through and heard some of the earlier testimony, I do believe that the nursing mothers, to the extent that it is your intent to clarify the definition of pregnancy discrimination, that nursing mothers, that respective language and what you're seeking to protect there would make sense, because that would then allow the department to define pregnancy in a way to cover nursing mothers. I don't believe currently such a definition or ability to protect such individuals exists under Minnesota law. And I do appreciate what was said earlier about the means by which to effectuate a quick resolution of the dispute. The opportunity to file something before the Department of Human Rights does allow individuals to get cases resolved before actually incurring substantial expenses within the court system. I have practiced law for more than 22 years now, every year as an employment attorney, and there are several cases which get resolved in the Department of Human Rights. I can think of two in the last week which weren't in our office more than 15 days, because we are an administrative agency, and if we can find something which is quickly established as a violation, we resolve those disputes. So for a nursing mother, the thought of having to actually retain an attorney, go to court, file something, can be a substantial burden to that individual. Being able to go to the Department of Human Rights and have an investigator have a quick conversation could quickly resolve the respective dispute, saving both the mother and the employer the expense.
Any other questions from members?
Is he going to comment on caregiver?
Yeah, Commissioner Lindsay, could you comment on the familial status and family caregiver portion of the bill? Only the House has that language on R22. And I guess if you could just explain to the committee what, you know, the Department of Human Rights Act protects against, you know, what the extent of it is. We're adding two new protected classes, familial status and status as a family caregiver. If you could just explain what exactly the Human Rights Act protects against for an employee.
Sure. The respective language in the House bill would expand the definition of currently which exists within the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We are talking here within this bill as relates to housing. Familiar status as relates to housing is broader than what exists for employment. So you would be, in essence, moving the definition of familiar status as relates an interpretation in housing into the area of employment context. The individual would be protected and would be treated similarly to other employees, and the issue of investigation by the Department of Human Rights would be whether there is differential treatment on the basis of the person's caregiver status. You have limited the caregiver status as relates to the respective language, giving definiteness to the department in its approach. Most of the cases that we receive within the department concern marital status. We do and have issued probable cause determinations for discrimination on the basis of marital status and individuals being denied being able to provide care and comfort for their spouse. There is a difference as relates to Family Medical Leave Act under the federal law, and an individual who may wish to provide care for either one up or one down, as I like to say it, their parent or their child, that would not be something which would be protected under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. That would be something which would be protected under federal law under the Family Medical Leave Act. So you would, in essence, be, and I believe Minnesota courts would interpret it in this way, they would borrow language from the Family Medical Leave Act to provide guidance to employers as relates to interpreting their rights and or their obligations under the law.
So, Commissioner Lindsay, just from my understanding from the Human Rights Act, for these protected classes that are spelled out, you know, marital status, sex, creed, religion, color, disability. So those, when you have a protected class under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, from my understanding, that means an employer during a job interview, say, can't ask whether or not you're married or can't ask what your religion is. In decisions in promotion, for example, if you're a protected class, employer cannot base promotion on your religion or color or marital status. Is my interpretation of that correct?
Madam Chair, it is correct.
And so by adding these, I mean, looking at just the language the way it is now, wouldn't an employer be able to ask in a job interview without adding our, if we don't add our new language, isn't an employer able to ask a potential employee whether or not they have kids or whether or not they plan to have kids? Or if an employer is making a promotion decision, is the employer able to say, oh, you know, this employee, she wouldn't want this promotion that's going to require more traveling because I know she has two young kids and she'd rather be spending time with her kids than to have this promotion. I mean, from my understanding of the current Minnesota Human Rights Act, there wouldn't be a discrimination remedy based on hiring or promotion for scenarios such as that without adding new language, providing that those are protected classes. And if you could just comment on whether or not I have that correct or not.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think you asked three or four law school questions in there. So at the end, you indicated within your question, she, as relates to travel. You began with your questions, is it inappropriate for an employer to ask a question, do you have caregiver responsibilities? It is not a per se violation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act to ask a job applicant as relates to, do you have caregiver responsibilities? I will tell you, though, that the EEOC and enforcement officers in my office probably will ask additional follow-up questions to see, because it historically has been the case, that employers have discriminated against female employees when asking that question. Your last question as it relates to is she would give more evidence to enforcement officers in my office and the EEOC that it is an appropriate question in which to ask, and you're trying to discriminate against female employees.
If it's gender-based, so what about a father then with two young kids? Would the employer be able to not promote a father because he has kids and the employer is assuming he'd rather be spending time with his kids than taking a promotion that would just, for example, require more traveling? What would the father's remedy be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is possible for a male employee on gender stereotyping to bring a claim either under the Minnesota Human Rights Act or under Title VII. It is not typically brought. There are not as many claims. We'll steal a headline from the newspapers about 2 weeks ago when a professional baseball player for the New York Mets was chided about the fact that he did not have his wife schedule her C-section before the season as opposed to opening day. That would be an example of gender stereotyping, which could support a claim by a male employee under Title VII.
So again, you would have to try. You'd have to make the argument that the discrimination is gender-based, as opposed to your status as a caregiver or your familial status, and that you have children. Correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct.
Are there questions from members? Commissioner Lindsay, did you have any other additional comments?
Did he talk about wage disclosure?
Oh, did he?
I don't think he did.
Wage disclosure.
Which I believe is on R25, Madam Chair.
Yes. If you could just highlight the differences. In the House version, obviously, we have it under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, whereas the Senate version has it under 181. If you could highlight the differences and what your preference would be.
The department would prefer the respective House language as opposed to the Senate language. Terms and conditions of employment, including wages, is protected under the Human Rights Act. To the extent of protecting that right to terms, conditions, wages, benefits, the department would view being able to discuss wages and benefits with your fellow employees is important to be able to protect that right to those wages and terms and conditions. There was earlier testimony as relates again to the means by which to facilitate resolution of the dispute. Again, the Senate language requires filing with court, which does mean additional cost to the aggrieved party. The ability to seek quick resolution through an administrative agency such as the Department of Human Rights may actually, again, reduce costs to the employee and to the employer.
There are questions from members on that piece. Thank you, Commissioner Lindsay. I think that concludes the portions that are under the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Madam Chair, I believe that is correct. There was a question concerning the National Labor Relations Act earlier. I think one of the earlier testifiers indicated she was an employment attorney and not a labor attorney. And I believe that is an important distinction for the committee to understand. The labor law would really have to go to the point of also making the additional factual determination that the parties were engaged in trying to form a union or engage in concerted conduct. And that concerted conduct puts an additional burden on the employee or the applicant to be able to establish. So there is a clear distinction in what you're doing between the National Labor Relations Act.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Chairman Lane, and thank you for that. And I had a quick conversation with the nonpartisan staff, and I'm wondering if you could share just the distinction we had very quickly, because I think that was important.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was directed
to the nonpartisan. I wasn't paying attention. Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair and Representative Krishna, we had a very brief discussion. Representative Krishna asked me about the kind of the basic coverage of the National Labor Relations Act and this idea of federal preemption. And the conversation we had was kind of the general scope of the National Labor Relations Act deals with labor relations and collective bargaining and things like that. And what is covered by the NLRA is except for very limited circumstances, always preempted by the federal law.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Crescia.
Yes.
It's okay. People mispronounce my name all the time.
I'm used to it. It's fine.
Any other follow-up? Thank you, Commissioner Lindsay.
Thank you.
Mike Hickey?
Thank you.
Are you here? I don't see him. Oh, there he is.
I
Welcome. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, it's Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And I wanted to make a few brief comments about the bill. I know we've been here a long time, so I'm going to make my comments brief. We are strongly opposed to the three provisions in the House bill that extend new coverage under the Human Rights Act. And the first one I want to touch on is caregiver familial status. We really feel this is a dramatic change under the Human Rights Act. It's a big departure. And importantly, currently, as most of you know, virtually all cases on the Human Rights Act are based on the individuals, on the individual and the characteristic of the individual. And this is a big change to a situation involving the individual. And we really feel this is the huge departure and probably the biggest issue you're facing in the litigation part of the bill.
Well, and Mr. Hickey, I have a question about what you just said, because I've heard that testimony in committee before about how the Human Rights Act protects the characteristics of a person as opposed to their status or who they are. But the current Minnesota Human Rights Act protects based on marital status and protects based on status in regard to public assistance. It provides protections for people who serve on some sort of board or committee. I don't have the language in front of me at all. So in that sense, it's really not a departure at all from what some of the current protected classes are, right?
Madam Chair, those are three. The other ones are what I indicated, a characteristic of the individual, an inherent characteristic. And we are expanding it to those three. You're correct.
Okay. Thank you.
But we still feel this is a big departure and one you really need to pay attention to. Virtually all of us could fall under the Human Rights Act at different points of our lives. And we just don't think this is workable. We think it's going to be very difficult for employers. The provision does not explain how employers will be able to enforce attendance or performance expectations of a worker who has problems in the workplace and is also in a caregiving situation. And we feel this is going to cause litigation against employers, be they private or public, and definitely going to be an increase in litigation and something very difficult for employers to try to deal with. Human rights claims can be very expensive and threatening to small businesses. One quote I got from a very active practitioner is responding to a claim can cost between $5,000 and $25,000. Going to an administrative hearing, he said in this estimate, a 3 to 4 day hearing could cost between $50,000 and $100,000, so maybe a little less for a 1 or 2 day, more abbreviated hearing. And going into district court, double to triple that, $200,000 to $300,000. So this is a very threatening and expensive proposition for small businesses to get caught in this. And that's something we're very concerned about and the expansion that's occurring. We're also opposed to the two other provisions that also include under the Human Rights Act both nursing mother and wage disclosure disputes. We feel a regulatory action would be much quicker, would be more economical, and certainly more efficient. And we support the Senate provision on all three of these. Urge you to take a hard look at it and feel the Senate did some real good work to try to mitigate litigation while trying to make advancements for people. And I think that's the fine line you have to walk here today. The House provision really is a dramatic expansion of the Human Rights Act. It really sets a precedent for where we're going after this. But obviously, this bill takes us a long way, and we really appreciate the Senate provisions and the work the senators put in on a bipartisan basis, and urge you to take a real hard look, and we support those.
Any questions from members? Oh, thank you.
You bet.
Mr. Gerber?
Can I have one question? Not to the testifier.
Representative Crescia?
Thank you, and thank you, Chairman Lee. Not to the testifier, but to the Senator Pappas. Mm-hmm. I'm curious your thoughts on the contrast in this. I certainly want to support my House author, but you guys had left this out. What were the thoughts?
Senator Pappas?
We felt that the because these were mostly employment issues, that they more appropriately belonged in the general labor law rather than in the human rights law. We were aware, however, that there were more limited remedies. And that's really a problem with our general labor law. Because I do like the idea of having a informal process, mediation, you know, just not forcing people to go to court or forget it. you know, with nothing in between. So I think if we can figure out some remedies in Dolly that can address some of these issues, then it might work as well there as it works in human rights without taking the step to go into human rights.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Gerber and Ms. Kelleher.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I'm going to lead us off today, so obviously I'm not Ben. I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent 2,000 elected school board members from around the state and 800,000 students that are in our public schools. So we're here today in a very unique partnership. This is a duo you never see at the Capitol and probably haven't seen ever. But we're here today on the same concern, and we're really here to support the Senate version of the bill when it comes to family caregivers. And let me give you my perspective from the school district perspective. School districts have more collective bargaining units than any other local government entity. Over 80% of our employees are women. They are paid professionally and on the equal pay scale through collective bargaining and negotiation done by themselves. And it is critical in what we do that we have employees who are there when the children start school and are there till the end of the day. Substitutes and replacing people who are on leave are a big deal in K-12 for the sheer fact that there is data to prove that when a classroom teacher isn't in with their students, academics suffer as a consequence. So, also, our last point is presently, if in fact we are part of this and we are dragged into a court situation, school districts have no levy authority of their own, and we would have to rely on a provision in law called the Tax Levy for Judgments. It's 126C.43 and 123B.25. Which would put any judgment rendered against a school district on top of the property tax payers for that school district. Our concern with that is school districts rely heavily on operating referendums to facilitate them and their needs of their students. We're concerned that if there is a burst of judgments or lawsuits, that could really negatively impact how the taxpayers view the school district and management of their affairs. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ben, who can actually give you a more critical legal.
Well, Ms. Kelleher, I have a question for you.
Sure.
You started out by saying that it's important that you have your staff and teachers there from the very beginning of the day to the end of the day, which we would all agree with. And you talked about the difficulty of getting substitutes in a classroom. Could you explain for us how adding familial status or status as a family caregiver to the Minnesota Human Rights Act would prevent you from having an employee there from the beginning of the day to the end of the day?
Madam Chairman and members, that's an excellent question. And I think we're dealing, at least from my side of the table, with an idea about family caregiving. I have elderly parents. They're in their late 70s. I worry about who takes care of them. I also have three children, plus four stepchildren, that I'm responsible for. So I get both sides of caregiving. What I think is the problem, and sometimes is the problem with really big ideas we think about there, is what does that look like when we implement that? Does there become then a rationale for coming in late? If I had to drop my daughter off at school before I came to teach at that school, do I have a solution to say it's okay for me to be late and I need to leave early to go pick up her, even if I have 30 little children sitting in those seats looking at me and I'm their sole source of academic performance? So it's an implementation concern much more than it is the thoughtful rationale that's behind the idea. So I want to make sure I give respect to the idea. Our concerns are, what does that look like when it rolls out across the state of Minnesota in public schools? That we did a quick survey of our individuals and found that we have over 8 different ways we call sick leave across the state,
all those contracts are locally negotiated, and this would go on top of those locally negotiated agreements.
Well, Ms. Kelleher, I think that there's a lot of confusion here on what the Minnesota Human Rights Act does. It doesn't provide special privileges to anybody. It just prevents against discrimination. Has nothing to do with sick time, has nothing to do with being late for work or leaving work early. It simply says you cannot treat those employees differently than you treat other employees. So, for example, if you had one teacher who was leaving early every day to go golfing, and you had another teacher that was leaving early every day to go pick up their kids, you couldn't fire the one teacher who was leaving early every day to go pick up their kids, but treat the teacher that was leaving to go golfing early differently. What we're saying is familial status and status as a family caregiver, they simply have to be treated the same as you treat every other employee. We're not saying that there's absolutely nothing in the Minnesota Human Rights Act that would allow them to be late for work or leave work early. It just simply says they can't be discriminated against. So I think there's been a lot of confusion regarding what the Minnesota Human Rights Act does. So I just wanted to clarify that when you bring up the scenario about how you wouldn't have staff and teachers there from the beginning of the day to the end of the day, because it's just simply saying that you have to treat those employees the same as you treat everybody else, which obviously you expect your employees to be there when they're required to be there. So just for clarity purposes, that's what the Minnesota Human Rights Act does.
Well, Madam Chair, Mrs. Keller, as an attorney, I think Mrs. Keller is getting at, and maybe it wasn't clear, is that the concern from this group, and it's a pretty substantial group, and I'll get to your question, but we have the Minnesota Business Partnership, the Chamber of Commerce, the Metro Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota School Board Association, the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and the National Federation of Independent Businesses that have all signed on to a letter that's in your packets. And our concern it is not just that people could leave early, but we're getting into an area of labor law which becomes really difficult to administer, and that's really where the concern is. So you can have one employee that, as Ms. Kelleher said, that was coming in late because they had to take care of their kids. You might have another employee that's coming in late for another reason that was sanctioned by the employer. And it could probably, for instance, because they were taking classes that had to do with what they were teaching, you then have a prima facie case of discrimination. There were two people that were treated differently, and one was under this terms a family caregiver. And so that's where the problem comes into. It becomes very difficult to administer. And the bigger problem is then, our position, and we talk about this in this letter, is this actually makes it worse for employees, because now you have the cases where an employer is going to be less likely to be flexible because they have a fear of if they treat one person one way, they're going to have to be it's impossible to always be consistent. And not every employee knows the circumstances of other employees, and there's good reasons for that. What I really want to get at, and I think another misunderstanding that we saw on the floor, Representative Moline, and we just saw again in the committee, there's going to be a three-step process that a judge will do when we're looking at a case under this. And first, you have on line 19.12, the House language, a family caregiver means a person who cares for another person. So obviously, you'd have to be caring for somebody. And then that person has to be related by blood, marriage, or legal custody, and that's the second piece of the analysis. And if that isn't met, then you go to the third step, which is where the problem lies in the definition. We don't dispute that familial status or family caregiver is, those are defined. What is not defined in statute anywhere is with whom the person lives in a familial relationship. There's no definition in state statutes of living in a familial relationship. There is the usage of familial relationship in 260C.21 under the child protection statutes, but it just uses the word familial relationship. It doesn't talk about persons living in a familial relationship.
Mr. Gerber, I believe that the Senate Judiciary Committee had passed language defining familial relationship.
They included a definition. They didn't include a definition of what's here. There's no definition in your language.
Saying there exists, that Senate Judiciary passed a definition of familial relationship, which is what we were discussing earlier. Maybe it was before you got here, but regarding narrowing down what that definition would be as far as familial relationship goes. Familial status is defined. Familial relationship is used in several places in Minnesota law, but it's not clearly defined, so we could simply provide a definition for familial relationship.
Yeah, and I think, so you could, yeah, certainly you could define it. I think the greater problem, it goes back to the implication of this, and which is the administration and how employers, and you're hearing from a large swath of probably the greater majority of employers in the state that have significant concerns with this provision.
I understand that, but there's also been a great amount of confusion surrounding this provision, in that everybody keeps, you know, painting it as if we're giving special privileges to people, when in fact we're just saying that they have to be treated the same as every other employee. And the Minnesota Human Rights Act, in regards to all the protected classes, says except when based on a bona fide occupational qualification. So, you know, if part of your job is to be supervising your classroom, if that is part of your job, then you can't have a special exception under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, even if you're a protected class. So, I mean, I think I understand that you have been opposed to this provision all along, but there's been so much confusion over what this provision actually does, and all it's saying is family caregivers have to be treated the same as every other employee. And it brings up some of the questions I was raising earlier about, and the motherhood penalty is real. Female employees who have children are 50% less likely to get a promotion than female employees who are single, because they're perceived by their employer as they would rather, you know, spend more time with their kids than have this promotion that might require them to be away from home more. So, I mean, I think we're getting at real issues to try to address some of these concerns as far as just discrimination in the workplace goes, not any sort of special privileges, but just discrimination in the workplace, which is what the Minnesota Human Rights Act does.
Madam Chair, I mean, to answer your question, what this would do, it would have the opposite effect and make it harder for accommodations and employers to accommodate the needs of their employees. And that's what we've heard from these organizations and the people that they represent, and the members that I have expressed significant concern.
Okay.
So, and I also want to point out too, one of the things that was mentioned is that there are that it's only civil remedies under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and I'd like you to point you to Minnesota Statute Section 363A.30 sub D 4. In addition to all other remedies provided under this chapter, every person who commits an unfair discriminatory act as set forth in sections 363A.11, or aids, abets, incites, compels, or coerces another to do so, shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. So you have other issues. We're not just talking about civil penalties. We're talking about criminal penalties, and who those would be applied to, we're not sure, but whether it be HR or the owner of a business. But these are not just civil penalties that are available under the statute. There are criminal penalties as well. And that brings me back to we are separate.
We're now separate, so I will sit down, Madam Chair.
The Chamber has other concerns, specifically on wage disclosure. And I want to correct some of the statements that were given on the National Labor Relations Act. The National Labor Relations Act does have some limitations. It applies to non-supervisory employees, not just people that are non-salaried. You can't just have a salaried employee to get around the issue. It's non-supervisory, and it doesn't just apply in specific instances where people are trying to form a union. It includes statements that employees make to each other. So, if the committee would like, I can bring in a National Labor Relations Act lawyer to explain the differences. But there, and I think in the hypothetical that was given, you're talking about line workers. Most line workers are not supervisory. That's not always the case. So it would apply. And if you look at the remedies in the Senate language, the reason those remedies are there is that's what the National Labor Relations Board in the TaylorMade Transportation case issued, and that's the seminal case on wage disclosure violations. It was fairly recently decided within the last 3 years, I believe October 2012. And those were the remedies that were provided by the National Labor Relations Board and approved.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Except Mr. Gerber, when you recommended that language, you left out attorney fees.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, attorney's fees are not expressly provided for in the National Labor under the National Labor Relations Act. They are not. They were not expressly provided for in that case, nor in some specific instances they can be granted, but it's not given under that act. There have been cases, but under the TaylorMade case, and in most cases, it's not a guarantee.
Mr. Gerber.
So our concern, too, just from the standpoint of the wage disclosures, we've heard that from the commissioner as well as other advocates that disclosing their wages is an important piece of uncovering gender discrimination. I think when we're talking about here, though, under the Senate language as well as the House language, this is a different cause of action. And I'd like to also point out that the equal pay law is under 181 as well. It doesn't have remedies under the Human Rights Act. So there is precedent for having this set in 181. This is where it belongs. That doesn't mean that they couldn't be part of a greater claim and included in a claim, but to have them, disclosing your wage is not a human right. And I think to put it in there from a legal standpoint as well as an administrative standpoint doesn't really fit with what I believe is trying to be done here. So I think, from those two perspectives, I'd also like to bring up Beth Cadoon from the Chamber has some... Oh. You jumped in there. Beth would has some other things that she'd like to address.
Madam Chair, if that's okay, I was able to attend the hearing. I apologize, didn't get my name in, but I'll attend the two issues that I've been dealing with for the Minnesota Chamber, if that's okay.
Sure. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Beth Cadoon. I work at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just want to briefly mention two other issues that we do have concerns with. We are supportive of the Senate language regarding the pregnancy accommodations in R20. We do like the definition of inclusion of the undue hardship language and how that's defined and described in the Senate language. Over the House language, we're concerned on the House language is that it would create undue confusion regarding when you have reasonable accommodations. It's always defined with the undue hardship language. The Senate or the House language includes it as part of the transfer, and we think that would actually create a little more confusion. There's actually a National Women's Law Center that's proposing something similar at the federal level. And the National Women's Law Center is also using that same reasonable accommodation and including then that undue hardship language because there's a whole body of case law with the ADA that goes along with that. We think that will be much clearer both for the employer as well as the employee on what's then meant for that reasonable accommodation language. The other issue deals with the nursing mother. We're also supportive of the Senate language.
We have a question from Senator Seben.
So, Ms. Cadoon, thank you for speaking to those differences. Could you just clarify then that the way the language is structured on the pregnancy accommodations, I assume that you prefer the Senate language in the way that the difference in where the transfer language is included in the Senate, that structure of the bill?
Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, Senator Seben, yes, we prefer the Senate language on how it's structured as well as the undue hardship language that's included in that. The only caveat I have regarding the Senate language is actually in line 16.15 and 16.16. This is we're not quite sure how this would work. This gives basically veto power of one party in this, which would by the employee. Our understanding is this is kind of unusual inclusion for labor law and just to give one party veto power. So we are concerned with just that piece of language on the Senate side.
Please proceed with your...
The other piece I mentioned, which is we do prefer the Senate language on the nursing mothers regarding the remedy, and we do believe this does provide a faster remedy. It does provide for 15 days And then also administrative fine. We believe that is much faster through the Department of Labor. Realize this provision, we're going from no remedy under current law to providing a remedy, and this is the one that we think will be work better for both the employee and the employer.
Ms. Cadoux, what's the remedy for the employee under the Senate language?
Madam Chair, the remedy would be, as the idea is, so that the employee would have that nursing mother the accommodations, and this would then have the accommodations occur at the workplace, which is what the goal of the bill is.
Well, what if the accommodation doesn't happen and the employer gets fined? What's the remedy for the employee?
So the next step. Hopefully, if Mr. Gerber can maybe address what the next step might be on this one.
One of the things we checked with the Department of Labor and Industry, who made a call, and I don't believe they're in the room, but I asked them to follow up. I believe there would be an administrative appeal, but we don't know. So I think I heard some of the members of the committee say that it's a given that there isn't an administrative appeal. I'm not sure that that's true, but I will definitely look into that. To check if there is something that's something we haven't resolved.
Okay. I mean, my understanding of the Senate version of the nursing mothers is there is no remedy for the employee. I mean, if they don't accommodate, the employer gets fined $1,000 and it goes to the state. That doesn't mean that the employee gets to nurse. Doesn't mean she gets accommodated for. So I think that's what we had mentioned earlier, is the enforcement provision maybe is lacking in regards to what the employee actually gets out of it.
So. Madam Chair, I just mentioned this is when I think the law was stated that it was put in place in the 1980s, and previously there's been no remedy at all. And now this would be putting forth a remedy, which is a fine as well as asking them to cure.
Is there questions from members? Did you want to talk about other provisions?
Just one other provision, and I believe somebody else will be addressing this, so I'll just briefly mention. We do have concerns regarding the pay equity language and the differences between the two bodies, and I believe Jill Larson will be covering those issues for us as well.
Okay. Any questions from members?
Just one quick.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair Moline. And this is a question for my Senator counterpart. Taking Chair Moline's argument and just let... Was your intention on the enforcement that if something were to happen and the employee, would it be better for the employer to fix it before they got to the fine? I'm trying to figure out what you were trying to do on the remedy and support her idea.
Representative Kreisha, this wasn't a bill that I carried.
Okay.
Did you carry this one? Senator Sharon carried this section behind with the nursing mothers.
I'm just talking, the enforcement. I mean, we've had a lot of conversation about it. I'm trying to understand the contrast.
I think we have to check back with the authors.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ms. Larson?
I was surprised we're so
free. Ms. Larson, if you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I'm going to speak today just to the equal pay certificate section of the bill. And as Beth Cadoun from the Chamber mentioned, I'm kind of speaking for the business community in general, not just a business partnership, but we thought we would divide it up. Generally speaking, we support the Senate language on the equal pay certificates with a couple of minor exceptions. But I do want to point out, I think our major concern with the House language with respect to the equal pay certificate is on page R9 of the side-by-side, specifically lines 9.18 to 9.23. And the reason for that is because the language is very similar to comparable worth type language, and in some respects you could read it to be actually broader and more expansive than the current comparable worth law that applies to local governments. The requirement for employers to compare the compensation between men and women in these major EEO-1 major job categories would result in employers having to compare jobs that are completely different. No other state uses this type of requirement. The federal government that currently audits federal contractors for compliance with the federal equal pay law does not use this standard. The categories are just simply too broad for a valid comparison. For example, let me give you an example of just what one job category would be. The job category of professionals includes, just to name a few jobs, economists, umpires, psychologists, lawyers, teachers, reporters, surgeons, nurses, building inspectors, pilots. That's just a small list. So essentially what an employer would have to do is take all those different jobs within that category, compare the average compensation between men and women in those, and then they would have to basically say, well, if, for example, they were paying surgeons differently than they were paying reporters, there are certain factors that they could take into consideration to justify that. But the factors that are listed in the bill are not very clear. It's not clear to us that an employer would be able to take into account market factors such as supply and demand. There is language that says other mitigating factors. We're not really sure what that means. And so our concern is that it would be very expensive and burdensome for employers to do, but maybe more importantly, we're not really sure it would result in very good data to determine whether or not employers are complying with equal pay laws. The job categories are just too broad. Now, the concern then goes into the auditing process. So right now, the federal government can audit a federal contractor for compliance with equal pay laws. And they're very they can be very arduous, lengthy, costly audits. And the federal government does not use this type of a standard. They basically compare similar positions. And so I think we expect that if this language were to pass, the Minnesota audits would be more lengthy, more costly, and again, not really identify the pay discrimination that I think you're trying to identify in this bill. So that's our concern with that language. I think in general, we could be open to some of the other language in the House bill. The discussion also, I'd like to just mention on page R11 regarding revoking the contract. We do agree with the Senate position on lines 8.5 to 8.11 in terms of revoking the certificate. I think we'd like to have some further discussion maybe with the agencies about revoking the contract. Does the Commissioner of Human Rights have unilateral authority to revoke the contract, or does the agency that actually awards the contract, do they have a say in that? I think that's just something we'd like to explore a little bit further. And then finally, Madam Chair, with respect to the effective date, we would prefer the Senate language. Be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Other questions from members? Seeing none. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to be heard on the bills?
Huh? Somewhere at 5:30.
Oh, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Kristen Lonkerich with the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing the 144 hospitals and health systems in the state of Minnesota. Thanks very much for the opportunity. I just want to be very brief in my comments. And I just wanted to respond to something that Commissioner Lindsay mentioned. This is on page R9. And I'll point you to the House language, page 9, line 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And first, I just wanted to start by thanking both the House and Senate for recognizing that the reason that the healthcare industry asked for this exemption in the first place. And it's just for those members that may have not heard this in committee before. This is because our state public program folks, our state public program patients, come to us seeking care. And we were very pleased that the House and Senate kind of recognized this and included this language. And I just wanted to speak specifically to the House language or a parent or subsidiary of the entity on 9.1 and 9.2. It can be a very complicated legal arrangement where separate legal entities are created under the same umbrella organization to provide healthcare services in Minnesota. And this is a very common way of doing business in Minnesota and across the country. And the goal always is to provide the highest quality healthcare for all of our patients that are seeking care. And we would really prefer to avoid kind of different requirements for providers of healthcare services just because of a different legal status. And the house would include all of our service lines. One example of this could be Alina's recent merger with the Courage Center. And so for those reasons, the Minnesota Hospital Association asks that you would adopt the house language on R9, lines 9.1 and 9.2. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Seeing none. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to be heard? Well, members, I think that is, are there questions for staff before we conclude today? No? Seeing none? Yeah. Well, members, that concludes our public testimony for the day, and I think we're gonna recess, right? Recess until the call of the chair?
We adjourn.
Oh,
okay, each day we adjourn. We're not coming back today.
Right. Do we vote on that?
Do we need a motion?
Do we vote on adjournment? No. Okay. No. Well, members, we are adjourned.
Sorry. Yeah, no. We adjourned.